I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
I've been with these young adults this morning for a little while, so I'm able to tease them a little bit. I try not to put you on the spot like that. Special order of business, our roll call. Please note the roll. And a special order of business tonight is to welcome our three Thunder Mountain High School students, Chloe Varner, Justin Sleppy, Kathy Tran. These are 9, 10, and 12th graders. They've been with us, I think, to AML and maybe at one other meeting or something. And then today they came in this morning and sat in on one of our staff meetings and solved all of our problems on this agenda tonight.
Right.
So if
okay.
we have...
Okay.
And then we went down to the fire station and talked with the fire chief and the firefighters down there for about an hour. And they had a very interesting hour with them. I think they were excited once they left. They're all going to become volunteer cadet firefighters now. So. But our ride-along people, right?
Yeah.
All right, good. Good. So welcome, all of you guys.
Thank you.
Great to have you here with us. And Madam Beth, we have before us approval of minutes, February 23rd. And these are the minutes that we didn't do last time around.
That's correct, Mr. Mayor. I did receive some corrections already.
Okay.
And we'll add those to the minutes.
Okay, so if there isn't any objections to the adoption or if there's any corrections to the February 23rd regular assembly meeting, any other corrections? Okay, we'll accept them and you can add those corrections to it. Manager's request for agenda change. And Madam Manager, you have a one or two?
Excuse me. Yes. Pardon me. I would like to move transfer T-967 to be heard after Ordinance 2014-24-AG. They're connected, and we need to approve the ordinance first before we have the money to do the transfer. So they both are, it's related to docks and harbors.
Thank you, Madam Manager. Any other changes?
No, thank you.
Okay. Is there any objections to that? Seeing none, so ordered. And now we'll go into public participation on non-agenda items. I've got four or five people who wish to talk to us about non-agenda items. So what we'll do is go through these five first. And then we will have Mr. Kevin Jardell give us an update up on the hill, since so many interesting things are going on up on the hill. So we'll talk with Mindy Rogoli. All right, come on up here in this chair and give us your name and address and who you're representing. Thank you, ma'am. Steve Hamilton, you're next.
My name's Mindy Rogenkamp. I own the Franklin Street Barbershop over on 2nd and North Franklin. And I'm here because you're hearing things about they're going to do something with the parking lot across from us. And just kind of want to put my two cents in for consideration. Never done anything like this, so this is a little bit... nerve wreck. I can handle a couple guys in the shelter one, but... It's just that it's been really important for my shop having those 23 spots over there. I have a lot of elderly people with, problems of getting, being mobile, and that's a real short distance for them to come across. And the parking is, like everybody knows that it's tough. It's really tough around there. And by having that parking lot across from me, I can tell my guys, that's city parking and it's 75 cents and I always have 75 cents in my drawer, so park over there because there's, some parking places left over there. So it really helps out because that's my biggest complaint in the shop. Hopefully it's not a bad haircut, but most of the time it's the parking and trying to find it. in short order. So it's been a real lifesaver for me to be able to say, hey, that's open to the public now. And if we are thinking of, I realize we need to, you know, progress downtown and build new things, but if that's going to be one of the things that it's going to do, some kind of a business or apartment buildings, that it, we have some public parking, because there's just nothing for over 2 hours, or if it's very busy during the legislative season or the, it's just hard to find parking on those streets in there for the 2 hours. And sometimes it's really good, and I know the little gals that are people that go around doing the parking, you know, monitoring. Sometimes it's really good, and sometimes it's not as well done, so it takes, you know, people will park there all day if they can get away with it. So on the streets, and this just helps relieve a little bit of that. But if the consideration is not that I don't want it to be, you know, done something for the downtown, that's not it. It's just that we have some public parking underneath the structure or something like that, just to keep the businesses, especially the small businesses around there, flowing. It's really important for us. So that's my
turn. Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much, ma'am.
Okay.
Mr. Steve, how are you this evening?
Good. How are you?
Good.
Good.
Welcome up.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. My name is Steve Hamilton. I'm the manager of the Baranoff Hotel down on Franklin Street. And you folks have asked for public input on the Juneau Economic Development Plan, and I'm glad to be a part of a group that's going to be working with that. You've also asked us for our opinion. I was part of 100 people Thursday night on Franklin and Front Street projects, and I think it's great that you ask. Juneau does not have a long-range plan for downtown parking. The parking lot that Mindy just spoke about, the potential sale of that slipped in sometime, you know, during this economic development plan. And I really hope that you talk and, you know, to those of us who have businesses, my friends that have businesses down there, and you listen and you ask for input from us on that. Sky is the call over at the city. I know has been put out a survey to businesses and employees, and I know that hasn't come back yet. And I know the next step is asking the community for their input. And I just ask that before you make a decision about for sure about this parking lot over there, that you ask the community for their input. And I'm not sure how many of you have businesses in that area, but it really does affect us severely. And down the road with, just like Mindy said, you know, no one down there is anti-growth or whatever, but whatever you could do, you know, to work with developer to keep that public parking lot whole down there, it's really, really, really vital. It's not only to us, but it's the businesses on down Franklin Street. You know, parking is harder and harder, and the street traffic is tougher and tougher, I know, for the businesses. So I just ask that you keep that in mind and continue to ask for, you know, input from, you know, the citizens. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hamilton. Any questions?
Thank you very much, sir.
We have two other people, and we have one more with parking. Courtney
Manger.
Good evening.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Courtney Manger. I'm here as one of the two owners of Soggy Mountain Shop here downtown in Juneau. Along the same lines, guys, I just wanted to express how really impactful that parking is for us and how many people that won't shop with us because of the downtown parking. As far as people coming from the valley and just kind of getting people to come downtown to shop is difficult. And parking is the number one complaint, and I can't tell you how big of an impact that has on us. But besides that, just interesting to hear that there's a survey out to employees and businesses, because we haven't seen that. But our employees are struggling to park. We've had two cars with windows shattered. My car's been hit three times on Gold Street. Like, we used to tell everyone to park at Subport, and that option is gone now, and we're just running out of options to suggest to people, and that parking lot in specific has been huge for us to kind of tell customers and people, like, hey, there is parking downtown. Like, you can come down here. You don't have to go through the circle in summer, and there's a way to come downtown and park and come shop. And just, it's been huge for us, and we are appreciative to have it there, and I hope it continues, or other parking on North Franklin will be valued.
And for you and the rest of the parking people, there is a parking study going on right now that includes the Willoughby District and Uptown again. And we're moving forward trying to make plans with a consultant on what we're going to do about the parking downtown and how we're going to manage that. So I would just, if you don't know about that, please get involved. Please give your input into that. They have special meetings on it and everything. And don't be afraid to come back here and give your piece. That's fine. But there is a group of people that are looking at it right now.
So. Sounds good. Thank you. We just wanted to come together and present that as multiple people in Franklin.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you, ma'am. And then we have Ms. Patty Collins, Treadwell Advisory Committee.
That's on the agenda.
Is it?
Yep. For a public hearing tonight.
Mm-hmm. Consent
public
agenda?
No.
No.
Public hearing.
Okay. We'll put you in when we get to that, ma'am. Okay. And then we'll go to the consent agenda. Or Mr. Kevin Jardel, excuse me.
I think there was somebody else that signed up.
Oh, yeah. Thomas Hanley, Jackson Street, or CIP process. Come on up, sir. Putting too many OKs where they don't belong.
My name is Thomas Hanley. I live at 2925 Jackson Road on in Blueberry Hills subdivision. And we've just had a really bad process or experience with the engineering department involving capital improvement projects. It doesn't seem to be that unusual in talking with other people. And I just wanted to tell you about it and offer a suggestion that you might want to consider. What this involves is that the city's in the process of reconstructing all the streets up in the Blueberry Hills subdivision. It started with Pioneer and moved up there because of water line problems. Now, the plans for the Blueberry Hills subdivision involved removing all of the street trees in the subdivision and narrowing the street by 3 1/4 feet. The problem is that was never told to anybody by engineering. The only reason we found out about it, and it was unanimously opposed by every property owner, resident property owner there. The only reason we even found out about it was that I just happened to be talking with surveyors that were working up there last December, and they said, you know, all these street trees are going to go, and that's how I got into it. Now, the engineering plan first intended to just do this as a small streets project and not even run it through the planning commission, because they were just going to deal with just Jackson Street, and it's a small street, and even though it had subdivision-wide implications. They sent this public information or notice of the information to the residents just on Jackson Road, and it says the reconstruction work will include replacement of the roadway embankment, curbs and gutters, replacement of the water main and services, installation of a new underground storm drainage system, and new asphalt paving. Not a word about removing all the street trees, which would have changed the entire character of the public space up there, or narrowing the street by over 3 feet, which is a real winter safety concern for the residents there with the snow we get. If I didn't know about the street trees, I wouldn't have gone to the public meeting. I would have just thought, well, they're going to do a nice job replacing the status quo. But because I knew about the trees, I went to the public meeting. The public information meeting consisted of blueprints laid out on a table, 4 people standing there to answer any questions. They didn't provide any information other than the blueprints. The only reason that I looked at the blueprints and you could see remove tree written next to each tree, I didn't know that the streets showed that the asphalt was 22 feet wide in the drawing. I had no idea that the asphalt on the street currently is 25 and a quarter feet. We only found out about the streets at the very last minute in the discovery process of the planning staff writing a planning report for the Planning Commission. Now, the Planning Commission voted unanimously in our favor to keep the street trees and to keep the width of the streets. But, of course, that's only a recommendation. But the point is that this would have had a major impact on our community. It was of concern to every resident that lives there, and yet the only way we happened to know about it was that I just happened to be talking to a surveyor that December before. So I just want to suggest, my suggestion is that when engineering is going to be doing a CIP project that changes the status quo in a community, that this kind of letter should identify at least the key elements of the things that are going to change. Because if it had said remove all the street trees and narrow the street by 3 1/4 feet, there would have been a lot of people show up at the meeting. And that would have been good because, one, it would have given engineering a heads up about what kinds of opposition they might run into instead of dealing with it at the last minute now. And secondly, it might be even possible that the residents might have a good idea that could help solve a problem or at least understand what the problem is. And I just thought that I think it would take the body of you people to actually tell engineering to do something like that.
No, the city manager can, not us.
Okay, well,
thank you.
I didn't know where to begin, but, you're the elected body.
You're okay, right here. Thank you. Is there any questions for Mr. Hanlon? Thank you very much, sir. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Jardel.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. For the record, I guess Kevin Jardel, lobbyist for CBJ. The mayor asked that I come in and give a little update for what's going on the Hill, and it's not a lot of good news. People are taking their work very seriously, still working hard. So I'll run through this. Please stop me if there's any questions. I'm happy to pontificate as much as I can. Basically, on the current operating budget, a lot of things I'll be talking about is the operating budget. Governor Walker came in with a $250 million about cut to the last year's operating budget or management plan. House went from 250 to 370. And then the Senate just came out with a version from 370 to 470, which is about a 10.5% cut to the operating budget, which is a real cut, and it's going to certainly have impacts that constituencies and users see, and certainly in the capital city we will see some real impacts. As much as the $470 million is a large cut to the operating budget, what recently came out from Department of Revenue was a spring forecast of revenue going forward, and the spring forecast forecast $400 million less in revenue for the current year and maintains that projection for next year. So even though they took a $470 million cut in the operating budget, it's almost matched by a $400 million expected loss in revenue for the current year. So the gap, even with that large of a cut, really did not recede that much. And so it's still tough times up there, and the forecast for next year is to continue the same amount of revenues we have this year. So it's not great news coming from up on the Capitol. The session, we have 13 days left in the 90-day statutory session. They can go past that for 30 days under the Constitution if they so desire. Lots of speculation on whether they will or not, and I'm going to avoid that tonight. We'll just see what happens, and whatever happens, happens there. The Operating Budget Conference Committee should be appointed kind of middle of this week. If you're not familiar with it, the House passes an operating budget, goes over to the Senate. Senate passes an operating budget, and there's differences amongst those two in what they allocate for each agency and department. And so they appoint a conference committee which goes through each difference in the budgets and decides whether they take the House numbers or the Senate numbers or sometimes go back out and get full powers and come up with a compromise in between or completely new numbers. So when we talk about the budget items here, I'll be talking about the House numbers, the Senate numbers, and dealing with the context of conference committee and what we're looking at for the kind of the brackets there. So I'll run through these issues. There's no real order of them. The Marine Highway is an issue that we've been following for the community. They took fairly large or substantial, significant hits. The House took about a 4% cut to the management plan, which is the current budget. So you normally see some increases built into the plan. So we're not talking about those. We're talking about a 4% decrease from the actuals of last year. And then the Senate took about an 8.1% or 8% cut in their budget. So that's kind of the bracket of what we're looking at in the conference committees. It has significant impacts. The difference between the House and Senate in the operation part is only about $1.75 million. So even if the House numbers, which funds the Marine Highway System with a larger amount, the impacts to the service will be about the same. The Senate took a lot more money from the shoreside, the reservations, and the ferry terminal workers. And so the impacts to the operations and service on the water, regardless of whether they take the House or Senate, will be fairly similar. But the House numbers are a little better. So a few items here just to note the expectations from DOT. These aren't final, so things could change. But they think that through July through September, the Taku and the Malaspina will be laid up. Malaspina will not be running day boat service during this time from Juneau, Haines, up Northern Lynn Canal. So that day boat service will be a pretty significant hit to the amount of port calls that Juneau gets. October and November, Malaspina will remain in layup, so not be making her port calls to Juneau on the Bellingham run. And then in March through May, the Kennecott won't be doing the Cross Gulf, so we'll lose some port calls there. And then LeConte will be in our overhaul project for 6 weeks from April through mid-May, which will reduce some service. So some real loss of calls on Juneau from the ferries. It's not all that was cut from DOT. They had a $14 million reduction in road maintenance, highways, and facilities, airports. That's going to impact Juneau. So the analysis right now is that DOT, they divide roads into five categories, levels of category. Road one, level one would be kind of Egan. Two would be Douglas. Three... my notes here. Three would be Frisk Cove Road, a level four would be T Harbor, and a level five would be kind of Engineers Cutoff as examples. They would focus on, under this cut, they'll be focusing on level one and two, the main roads, and they will complete all of the snow plowing for those two prior to going to three, four, and five. They will have very little overtime, and so if heavy snows, those ones and twos will continuously be plowed before they can get to 3, 4, and 5. So DOT expects some impassable roads if we have heavy snowfalls in those lower categories during those storms. So real impacts to the roads as well as the Marine Highway, even though we tend to hear the Marine Highway more often. Education. Last year there was kind of an agreement for 3 years of funding. This year the funding was going to be $32 million increase in one-time funding. Governor Walker introduced his bill and suggested eliminating that $32 million increase and just having flat funding on the current level. The House accepted that and didn't add anything back, but the Senate came back in and took about a 4% cut of another $47 million. This is to the base student allocation. And so on top of or in addition to flat funding from education and not keeping that increase of $32 million, the Senate has cut it by $47 million. So that's in conference. House numbers are where the governor was, which is just flat funding for the BSA, and the Senate came in with a 4% cut. And so that's kind of the bracket of what we're looking at for impacts on BSA. And so we'll be kind of weighing in as a community and the school district and seeing what we can do to impact that. The other issue in education that's significant as far as the policy level, the governor had suggested a cut to forward funding of education. So the legislature, a number of years back, have started trying to forward fund so school districts would have an idea of what to expect for layoffs and whatnot. The governor suggested cutting it by 10%, and I think that when the Senate looked at it, they said, well, if you're going to cut it by 10%, you're really not giving school districts any idea of really what to expect for the funding, and so they cut it by 100%. So it's elimination of the concept of forward funding going forward, which in some way, some levels, is just fungible money if you have savings forward and you identify as education, kind of a moral debt there to do it because you can't dedicate it, or you just leave it in savings. It's still there. But it is a policy call that's a pretty significant change. Public broadcasting is another one that we've been following pretty closely because of the impact to the Capitol Complex and Capitol City with gavel to gavel, as well as just the interest of community members. But specifically, you know, really looking hard at gavel to gavel and its impact in keeping the Capitol here. There was some discussion at the Senate level. There have been cuts all along. So the House cut it from 5.3 to 4, and people believe that rural areas and gavel to gavel will still be fine. The Senate cut it from 5.3 from the governor to 2.5, so a little bit less than half. Still believe that we can maintain gavel to gavel at the current funding, but that's it's getting close to impacts, and so we'll be watching that as we go forward. Marijuana, House Bill 75, the CBJ Law Department has been heavily engaged working on the substance of the bill. This is there's several pieces of legislation out there dealing with the initiative. This one is really dealing with municipal impacts, licensing, how do you protest a license, how do you go about engaging in that process. And so we've had a lot of success with the legislators working the bill, taking the advice of CBJ, and I think your law department deserves a lot of credit for that. And so we have pretty good high hopes that we'll get that through, so we'll get some of the needed things for the city as far as being able to try to help regulate some of the impacts of the licenses. So that's moving through. Daylight saving time has become an issue. It's been introduced probably six times, I believe, but this year it's gotten some momentum. It passed through the Senate with quite a bit of support. Once it got to the House, we're starting to see a little more opposition statewide from the Alaska State Chamber and other organizations, Bankers Association, that see the impacts of going another hour away from Lower 48 commerce. For Southeast, we have a pretty significant tourism hit if we don't go to Pacific time and we lose daylight saving time. And so there's two issues that's really being debated here. It's one is, do you want to keep daylight saving time or not? But the second issue, especially for Southeast Alaska, is do we go to Pacific time? And if we do, can we get the rail belt to go to Pacific time as well so that we don't get off schedule, off kilter with other government offices and the rail belt, which creates some inefficiencies? If you just go 1 hour off, by the time you start an hour early, finish an hour early, and then lunch hours are off, you're looking at about a four-hour window where you're not in tune with other government agencies. And so for the capital city, it's a real concern for us to have that impact. So a group of working with local Juneau citizens, working with the Alaska Committee, trying to build a coalition to really raise the issue of, if we're going to get away from daylight saving time, we really want to push for Pacific time to protect our tourism interests, as well as stay on Pacific time with the rest of the state, and so we maintain that as well. And so that'll be heard in State Affairs this Thursday morning. We expect quite a bit of testimony. Would not be surprised if it moves out of that committee to Finance, where we'll have a great shot of having a thorough discussion there. Medicaid expansion, CBJ did a resolution that's been submitted. Thank you all for providing that. The reform measures for Medicaid are really the key at this point in the legislative process to getting Medicaid expansion. Those are being worked heavily. There's three hearings in House Finance this week on the Medicaid reforms. It's too early to say kind of what the prognosis is for passage, but when you see three hearings in House Finance at this time of year, you can rest assured that they're taking it very seriously and putting time into it to do their due diligence. Language was added to the operating budget that would attempt to prevent the executive branch from accepting Medicaid expansion without legislative approval. There's some questions as to whether it does that or not, but it was put in there. So the focus right now, I think, is working with the teams on the reform efforts. The department is heavily engaged with that, and we'll see how that goes. State passenger head tax came up. Senator on Senate Finance introduced an amendment to not appropriate the funds to the ports, the first seven ports, kind of the state head tax. In dealing with that senator's office, I think that there is a legitimate issue that's trying to be fixed. There's a situation currently where the CPV fund is over-appropriated, and so they spent more than they took in. And so the Senate Finance looked at that and said, you know, that's a problem. Why don't we delay appropriating the monies for a year, and then after we delay it for a year, we can actually appropriate actuals instead of estimates, and we won't get into a situation where we're spending more than we've actually taken in. Working with that office, there's actually two different mechanisms working. You have the seven ports of call. Then if there's money left over, there's discretionary spending of that money in a capital budget. And the discretionary funds are really what has pushed that fund into an over-appropriation scenario. So we think there is there's a way out of here to fix the concerns with suggesting that they not spend any of those funds in the capital budget, but we still get the operating budget, so the seven ports of call still comes in. And because that's based on actuals, we shouldn't have an over-appropriation problem. And so we're working with the Senate to get that solution kind of in there. So we think we can fix their problem and still get the head tax money. And I can tell you that the senators that I've been working with have no interest and express no interest in keeping the money from the ports. It's really a focus on the over-appropriation concern. And like I said, I think we can solve that in a different way. Municipal revenue sharing. FY15 was $60 million. FY16, this next current year, is $52 million, and that's about a $90,000 cut to Juneau's share of that appropriation. We have heard from the governor's office that he will be supporting funding, at least at the current level, $50 million or thereabout, for next year. That's certainly good, but as we see in the House and Senate, It's a legislative process, and so it helps to have the governor propose that, but it doesn't mean that it can be counted on. But at least for this upcoming FY16, we only expect about a $90,000 cut in the municipal revenue sharing, which is good. Not to miss the revenue side of things, even though you don't see a lot of it in the papers, revenue is being heavily discussed in the legislature. Ledge Finance is going door to door, doing proposals, letting people understand what the levers are that they can move as far as potential revenue sources going forward. The governor last week in a speech to Commonwealth North in Anchorage announced that he will be doing a conference of Alaskans where he will be inviting Alaskans to the University of Alaska, and he will be presenting different options as well as making public a model where every Alaskan can put in what an income tax would look like at 4% or 5% or 6%, and you can see, you know, how much revenue it generates, or you can look at earnings from the permanent fund and see what it generates, and play with a model that actually allows everybody to kind of understand what you can really get from a revenue side from different proposals. And he's announced that he's going to release that. He's going to have this conference of Alaskans where he's going to ask people to weigh in and contemplate what is the solution moving forward for not just cuts but revenue as well. And lastly on that, Representative Seaton from Homer introduced a bill to help get that conversation started last week that suggested a 15% income tax on your federal liability. So whatever your effective tax rate is that you're paying for the IRS, you would have a 15% liability to the state on that federal liability. And he introduced that to get the conversation started. So the revenue discussions are beginning, and I expect to hear a lot more about that over the next interim and next year's legislative session. So those are the issues that I kind of identified as things that are kind of on my plate for the next 2 weeks. There's other smaller ones, so if anybody has any questions or issues. Or?
Kevin, have they had time to really vet their cuts, or are they just slicing and dicing? I mean, like a marine highway. Are we going to have enough of a marine highway system to meet our southeastern needs, which is what the marine highway was started for?
Yeah, I think they have been doing quite a bit of due diligence. The governor commented just the other day in the paper, he sees people leaving when he leaves at 10:30 at night, and I do too. I see people up there working very hard. The commissioners have been heavily engaged. The departments have been engaged. The governor, you know, set forth kind of a goal to his departments of a 25% ultimate cut over several years. And so they've gotten the message that, you know, the situation is what it is as far as the finances, and we need to look at cuts. And so the departments have been heavily engaged with legislators and trying to work through the cuts that will have the least impact while still making some significant cuts. But AMH is going to have real impacts to communities.
Other questions? Ms. Troll.
Mr. Jordell, so is there anybody kind of paying attention to the whole cumulative impact scenario on communities? You know, in other words, I mean, so if we're going to have $90,000 less in revenue sharing, then we have the hits to education, the ferry, we have state employees being lost. It ends up being a real significant effect on a community like Juneau. So I was just wondering, we have all these little programmatic cuts, but cumulative, they add up, and where does that end up in the picture?
Yeah, thank you. And I think they do a good job of that. There's a committee process where in the House and Senate, both sides, the Finance Committee breaks up each department into a subcommittee, and then each subcommittee sometimes gets a little stovepiped on that one department and looks at that one department very closely. And then once the subcommittee process is over, they bring all of those parts back together to make the full budget. Then the full Finance Committee really debates that. Once it gets back to the Finance Committee, they really do discuss that pretty thoroughly on the cumulative impacts, and a lot of discussion on that. It's really balanced against what do you think is going to happen over the next 2 to 5 years or 6 years. If you run out of savings too soon, and you know, in some scenarios we look at maybe 3 years, if you have a cliff of no real savings left to kind of do a glide path down, you know, what is the cumulative impact going to be at that day? And it's a different philosophical argument between those people, and so absolutely, I don't think anybody up there is doing this without really thinking about and understanding the impacts to real people and communities.
Mr. Keel?
Mr. Mayor, my great appreciation to Mr. Jardel for his work, which is extensive and hard, and I will just share an answer to the earlier question that I think he is generous. Over and over again, commissioner after division director after admin service director, when asked for the details, will the cut close this office or that one, and this service or that one, says, I don't know, but I'll figure it out. So I think that the assessment of how carefully the analysis is going on may be generous. I think the assessment of the macro effect, however, how long will the savings last, and in what scenarios, is probably accurate. I think that is the primary focus.
Mr. Jones, anyone else with questions for Mr. Cardell?
Questions?
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Kevin.
Thank you.
We'll see you on the Hill in the next couple of days again.
Tomorrow?
Yeah, tomorrow's good.
Tomorrow's the day after. Okay. Well, that was fun. Everybody want to go home now? manager's request for a... Let's see, we did that. Public participation, we did that. And Kevin, we did him. And we'll move to the consent agenda. Ms. Becker, consent agenda.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I move to that we adopt the consent agenda and ask for unanimous consent.
Is there any... Excuse me, go ahead.
I think in the agenda change, we moved one item. Does that have to be part of the motion, or since we moved it on the agenda, we're okay?
We moved it to another part of the agenda, so it'll show up there when we get to that.
Okay.
Can you tell me which one again is it? Because I couldn't find it when you talked about it.
Towards the end of your consent agenda?
So the transfer, T967.
I'm sorry.
And it will go. I'm sorry. Yeah, the page numbers.
Thank you.
I apologize. And it follows 2014-24-AG under public hearing.
Okay, thank you.
It's about five pages from the back.
Okay, is there any objections to the consent agenda with the one transfer taken out till later in the meeting? Hearing none. So ordered. We move to public hearing. Madam Clerk, the first order of business is 2014-24-AD.
An ordinance appropriating to the manager the sum of $16,500 as funding for the Regional Tactical Emergency Casualty Care (RTECC) course. Funding provided by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Madam Manager, administrative report.
This funding is to pay for half the total cost of $33,000 for a regional tactical emergency casualty care course. The remaining $16,500 has already been secured from the 2014 SHSP state grant provided from the Alaska Department of Military and Veterans Affairs 2014 State Homeland Security Program. There's no match or reporting requirements for this funding. I recommend adoption of this ordinance.
Thank you, Madam Manager. I will open for public comment. Anybody in the public who wishes to comment on ordinance 2014-24-AD at this time? Seeing none, public comment is closed. Assembly action. Ms. Gray.
I move adoption of ordinance 2014-24-AD and ask for unanimous consent.
Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Madam Clerk, please move to the next ordinance, 2015-02.
An ordinance amending the official zoning map of the city and borough to change the remote subdivisions area map for Hidden Valley Tract B, located in the upper Lemon Creek Valley, from not remote to remote.
Thank you. Administrative report, Madam Manager.
In April 2014, the applicant applied to have Hidden Valley Track B, located in the upper Lemon Creek Valley, rezoned from not remote to remote. On May 14, 2014, the Planning Commission recommended approval of the rezone application. The proposed ordinance was pulled from the Assembly's agenda when it was learned that the applicant had a concurrent easement application pending that would have provided road access to the property, which would appear to make the property ineligible for a remote designation. It was subsequently learned that the applicant had constructed or improved a gravel roadway to the property, connecting it to the roadway without CBJ's knowledge. On December 9, 2014, the Planning Commission reconsidered the rezone application and determined that the existence of a 12 to 16 foot gravel roadway did not mean the track was connected to the road systems CBJ 4770-1120. The Commission recommended that the Assembly approve the map amendment. The Lands Committee heard a presentation on Ordinance 2015-02 at its January 26, 2015 meeting. After public hearing on Ordinance 2015-02 at the regular Assembly meeting on February 2, 2015, the ordinance was referred back to the Lands Committee for consideration. At the March 2, 2015 Lands Committee meeting, CDD address CBJ's 4915465A, requiring that all lots in a remote subdivision have frontage on a navigable water body and that there be no reasonable probability that frontage on a right-of-way will be necessary for access. Upstream of Glacier Highway, Lemon Creek is classified as a non-navigable by the state. If the Assembly approves Ordinance 2015-02, CBJ 4915650 will need to be amended, as would the proposed subdivision ordinance, which articulates the same remote subdivision policy. And the ordinance's effect date should be conditional upon that amendment. If the Assembly denies Ordinance 2015-02, the remote subdivision policies would remain unchanged. Additionally, ATF has confirmed that should the subdivision be allowed with road access, ATF will consider the access road a public highway and will expect compliance with the agency's buffer requirements with respect to a number of explosive storage facilities near Hidden Valley. I have no recommendation as this is an Assembly policy decision.
Thank you, Madam Manager. And I will open up this to public comment, and I have three people signed up. Is there anybody besides Mr. Jim Clark, Mr. Zach Worrell, and Mr. Jim Eliason? Is there anybody else who wishes to comment on this? Seeing none, will Mr. Clark, if you want to? If that's who you want, that's okay. And we'll do 3 minutes each.
But, no. It will go after 3 minutes.
Okay. Hi, I'm Jim Elias, and I, along with Zach Clark, are partners in this thing. I live in Cheyenne, Wyoming, but I spent a lot of time here in Juneau before moving to Cheyenne. So I'm fairly familiar with the process, not familiar with sitting up here and talking at all. So bear with me. I came up because I felt like I've left an awful lot on Zach to deal with this stuff, and it's been a real trying thing for Zach and me as well. We thought we got into this with the right reason. We thought, God, how could anybody have a problem with what we're doing? You can't even see what we're doing. We're way up past, I think you all know where we're at, and it was just like, man, how could anybody have a problem with that? We're not on Egan Drive. We're not any things that I've been involved with in the past. We're not here. We're up there. So we went down this path. At first, city staff was ecstatic about it. So we went to CDD. They were fine with the project. We went to City Lands. They were fine with the project. We go a long ways, and then all of a sudden, boom, it's like somebody figured out that we were back there and doing something that I still haven't figured out what they're possibly upset about, but they are already left my notes, so I'm going to ad lib from here on out. All we're asking is a fair shake at this. If there's something somebody wants us to change, we're more than willing to change whatever. We've never been given that opportunity of, hey, Jim, hey, Zach, why don't you guys do this, and we're fine with that. It's been one thing after another of, you can't do that because of this. And they really are, in my mind, and obviously I'm biased, lame excuses that somebody comes up from a code book this thick and comes up with some excuse. I'm going to let Mr. Clark and Zach speak to the specifics. I just wanted to say how disappointing this has been on something that I just can't imagine, with all the difficult things you've got to deal with, from the budget crisis to, you know, people getting up and raising hell with you about just about everything you do, that this is something you guys would choose to fight just because I think in my mind you've been told to fight by somebody, and I obviously don't know who or why, but
There's my buzzer.
Thank you, Mr. Eliza. And I just want to assure you that the Assembly has been trying to understand the project, understand the pros and cons of it, and most of us have not made up our mind completely yet.
I understand that. So when I'm speaking, I'm not... You guys, I get first shot at it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Eliza? Zach, are you going to go next? Or Mr. Clark?
My name is Jim Clark, and I'm probably screwing up the... There we go. My name is Jim Clark. I live in 1109 C Street, and I'm the attorney for this project. We have a basic process request of you tonight. What's in front of you tonight is a map amendment. The map amendment is the gateway for us being able to negotiate the rest of the process. What's the rest of the process? This concept is for a rural set of cabins, much like Forest Service cabins. They are connected by a 14 to 16 foot trail, and therein lie the concerns. We have pledged that we would come up with covenants that would protect the city and borough from folks coming in here and saying, you know what, we want a road to the place, we want lighting, we want city streets. There's a lot of concern about whether we can put covenants together that would meet those specifications. What we have in mind is not only covenants that run with the deeds, but interlocking covenants, so that if my neighbor out there wants to put in city lights, I'll be able to protect the area because I'll have the right to sue that neighbor if they attempt to overstep the rural nature of the project. We ask that we get the opportunity to do that. If you pass this map amendment tonight, this will come back to you. It will come back to you when the easements that we need to negotiate with staff are complete. Those easements will be the repository, and or the subdivision itself will be the repository of these covenants to protect the city and borough of Juneau. And we believe that that will really, we think we can satisfy you. I don't want to speak for Mr. Palmer, with whom we've worked on this, but I think if you ask him, he'll say that what we've proposed on the table to start the negotiations is pretty good. Another concern here has been precedent. 49-70-11-20 says should not allow a remote subdivision where there is a road connection. It also speaks to where there is a electric and water. The precedent issue was dealt with in Spoon Island because it was decided that because it said should not, you could put in electricity and water to the Spoon Island subdivision. So even if you kill this project tonight by denying the map amendment, you still have the precedent issue to deal with. And the final thing I've heard has just been kind of surprising, and that is the belief that, can I just finish the sentence? That no matter what we come up with as covenants, that it won't be sufficient because when folks come marching in here asking for relief, the city will probably give it to them. We believe that, that's going to not be the case because we'll have the interlocking covenants of which I spoke. And secondly, just imagine this. What if we built the road or the trail only within 100 feet of the various projects? That would mean we came within 49-70-11-20. Wouldn't you still have the problem of or the concern of people coming from the subdivision and asking you to build them a road and city lights and city streets? So the concern needs to be taken care of with the covenants, and we believe we can do that. Ask for the opportunity by having you pass that MEP amendment tonight. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Any questions for Mr. Clark? Mr. Zach Warrell. Good evening.
Good evening. Zach Worrell, 155 Cordova Street, Juneau. So I'm going to do my best to address in a few minutes. I feel kind of strange about doing this. I mean, this is going to be tough in this a lot amount of time, but the main concerns, there's been a lot of concerns on this, and I think we've done our best to mitigate all of these things. I'm going to cover two. The first one being concern with our access routes proximity to powder magazines. For the last 3 or 4 months, I've been working with...
Mr. Worrell, you really don't have to cover that with us tonight, because that isn't really a part of... That'll be negotiated or discussed when you take the next step.
Okay, so long as it doesn't prevent us from getting to the next step, I'm... That's was all I was trying to
But if you want to
happen,
speak, go ahead, but you're going to use up a lot of your time. So.
Okay. I won't then. I won't speak to it. Thanks for the heads up. I'll move straight to some of the positives that could come from this remote subdivision. Some good things to say. I've been to 12 committee, commission, and assembly meetings on the subject of this project so far, and I've yet to hear any negative public comment. And all the time I've spent down here listening to other causes, I've heard plenty of negative public feedback. So that's a positive. Nobody has a problem with this project in the public. In your packets, I've included several letters of public support, people who live in Juneau, people, seasonal employees, etc., who really want this thing to happen. And as a result of allowing us to get a chance at the subdivision, we're going to see increased property tax revenues, which is something that can never hurt at a time like what we're having right now with budget crisis. Affordable housing is another thing that I think could benefit from this. If we have all these seasonal tourism workers coming up here and taking up the cheapest rental units downtown, that displaces low-income Juneau families. And as an alternative to that, that's actually, that user group has been that user group has made up the majority of the public support. And if we can get these people up there for the summertime, it's a small step, but it's a step. And I guess I'm done.
Is there any questions for Mr. Warren? Mr. Joe?
In the interest of giving you a little bit more time to explore some of the issues, would you explore more of the issues that you were just talking about? I understand sort of the remote subdivision out of the way. People use that for a second vacation or a place to go hide out. You talk about it as alternate housing for seasonal employees. Sort of without a road access, without, you know, how viable is that in your mind as a market that somebody would come up here for summer employment, would live that far away, not on a road system, not near bus transportation, as a part-time employee to get back and forth to work? I don't understand that argument as a reason for us to support a MAP amendment that allows you to move forward.
Access to our site is not difficult, especially in the summertime when there's no snow to impede. I could see it taking – I've never done it. I mean, I've never tried to figure out exactly how long it takes to get downtown, but I see it being comparable to Key Harbor or something. You know, it's not that much of a stretch. And I'm not an expert on real estate as far as what's marketable to people, what people want. But I have had a real estate professional write a letter in which she states how much interest there actually is in this type of property and how desirable it actually is. So I don't think that, I'm not sure it's my place or, sure, I'm relying on selling these lots, but I think there's enough interest to merit doing it.
A second question then, in terms of, as I read the record, as I sat in through the Planning Commission when you were before the Planning Commission, and you and I've talked, and I've basically said I was very surprised and disagreed with the Planning Commission saying this, this wasn't a road, what you put in there, that it wasn't, and as such, it wasn't connected to the road system. Can you explain to me how a 16-foot wide path that you can drive your truck up, that you can navigate, is not a road?
Well, as you said, the Planning Commission has been over this twice, and twice they've recommended this for approval. They feel that a 12 to 16-foot wide path that you can seasonally navigate with a vehicle, and it's not a Lincoln, I'll tell you that, doesn't constitute a road. Secondly, there are four criteria that, not criteria, they're characteristics. I think it's 49.70.110 that a remote subdivision should adhere to these criteria. Anyway, those criteria through past remote subdivision case studies have been proven to be suggestive and discretionary, and among those characteristics are not connected to the road system. So if you were to say, okay, we don't believe the Planning Commission made an accurate decision, that's sort of nullified by these characteristics that have through past precedent, their suggestions, they're discretionary. So if it says not connected to the road system, that's not a deal breaker. It's the intent. Does the property meet the intent for a remote subdivision? And I say yes. The Planning Commission has said yes. If you look at other remote subdivisions in the area, Spoon Island, for instance, does that meet the criteria of a remote subdivision? We're 3 miles from the nearest anything. I say we do.
Thank you.
Mr. Kim.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Mr. Worrell, help me with emergency services. Help me with how the ambulance gets here.
We fit in the same category as Shelter Island. We're outside of service area 9. There's no... It's the same as living out the road beyond where the fire service area ends. They're going to help. I mean, they're going to help you. The response time is going to be greater. They don't have any. If they decided it was going to be dangerous or something to put your fire out of your house, they don't have to do it. The same thing as the Shelter Island. And I'll leave it at that.
Ms. Pearl.
Thanks. You know, what I'm struggling with is on one hand, you talk about this as a part of a solution to affordable housing, and you're going to put the covenants on. So we're thinking of, and you're close to town, but yet you're still remote. So we start to think about, you know, potentially young families moving there. And then we flip it around, and really you make a reference to Shelter Island, and then it becomes that, yeah, that's right, the remote subdivision was originally designed for recreational sites, you know, navigable by water. And is this for recreation cabins? And if so, why hasn't anybody ever spoken to the recreational values of going through an industrial area and driving by on a shaky road with explosives and all that. I just don't understand the recreational value of this area. And so I can't wrap my head around what is it you really are. You're trying to be both things, working through the different wording of the amendments. And
well, you do indeed travel through some dicey industrial areas to get there, you're right. But you're so far removed from any industrial areas when you're actually at the site. It's that picture behind you, if you were to draw a straight line between your head and the end of it, would be about where you'd wind up. It's almost like it's untouched back there. So that's kind of part of the beauty in the site, is that it's relatively close, but it's a long way away at the same time. And I think that's what appeals to a lot of the people that would otherwise maybe have a lot on Shelter Island or who knows where else. But it doesn't take a boat to get here. You can get here any time of the year. You can get here after work. You can get here on weekends. Does that help?
Helps a little bit, but there's no fishing. There's no real access to prime hunting. You go through the industrial area, and then once you get there, it looks kind of okay. But Shelter Island has very significant recreational attributes to it. A lot of the remote subdivisions that we've honored, and that this ordinance sort of put in place to. You know, I get that part, and I'm trying to translate that to a land-based remote recreation site, and that's in an industrial area.
It's not in an industrial area. You drive through an industrial area to get there. If you give me a minute, I could pull up something on my computer. I didn't do it because I only had 3 minutes, but there's a remote subdivision area map that. Do you mind if I pull that up?
I've seen the map.
Okay. So you know it encompasses that 95% of the land contained within this map that's eligible for remote subdivision is actually on the mainland and is inland. So there's to say that remote subdivisions were only intended for coastal lots, it's not supported by the code that's in this book, that's for sure. I've heard that from a bunch of people before. I think the most easily developed land designated currently as remote was on the water. It's easy to get to, but that's not to say that it's absolute. The land use code completely supports what we're doing. We own three parcels of land back there. Two of them are already designated remote. We could do a remote subdivision on them right now. I don't see how that would be any different if I came to you then. If you say, well, I don't like the idea of doing it there, I don't understand why it would appeal to somebody. I think we should let the market dictate who it appeals to.
And then if it becomes affordable housing and families and expectation of services, then I have a whole other set of concerns. So that's why I'm just asking these questions. And thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Can I address that?
Yes.
Okay. Sorry, I'll be quick. There will be no expectation of ever having public utilities at the site. We've proposed restricting the deeds and the properties to disallow ever being connected to public utilities, ever having any public maintenance of a private right-of-way. So that's among several other measures of protection that we're trying to offer the city to indemnify them from any possible future financial burden from this thing. I think we've done a pretty good job of it.
Ms. Quattacchi.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Just a quick question. Just a minute ago, you said that the code supported your definition of, remote subdivision. How does that jive with 4970.1120 that says privately owned land proposed for inclusion within a remote subdivision should not be connected to a road system?
The intent of that is to say, okay, you have remote land that you want to access. If it is on a co- if the parcels you're looking to subdivide are coastal, The right-of-way requirement, an overland access right-of-way is not required for those lots. That's simply saying you can get there by boat. You don't need to have an improved right-of-way. There's a section I'm going to reference right now that further supports that. Sorry, I've got these taped to remember where they are. Oh, are you talking? I'm sorry. I thought you were talking about. Wait, are you?
I'm talking about 4970-1120.
4970-1120. Okay, hold on a second.
Remote subdivisions should not be connected to a road system.
Oh, Roger. Thanks, Jim. Okay, so there's precedent from. There's only been one other major remote subdivision done in the borough since this code was adopted. That was Spoon Island. In this criteria, there's criteria A through D. I'll briefly summarize these. Criteria A is you shouldn't consider a remote subdivision that's in the general proximity of a capital improvement. B, remote subdivision should not be in the vicinity of a growth area. C, connected to the road system. D, served by a right-of-way, sewer system, water system, city utilities, etc. So these four characteristics of a remote subdivision, these are, say they should not shall. In the Spoon Island staff report, it was said, and they devoted about three sentences to this. I devoted a year to it, approximately. they said, although Spoon Island has city water, grid electricity, bundled cable with telephone, high-speed internet, all the stuff, they got fire hydrants out there. Although Spoon Island has all these things, which disqualifies them from meeting all four of these characteristics, the subdivision review committee feels that these four characteristics that you define, or that you've mentioned in 49.70.1120 are discretionary. That is to say, they're suggestions, and the subdivision review committee, I'm trying to remember the quote verbatim, but I won't be able to do it. I'll tell you that right now. But the subdivision review committee said that they felt that the benefits of having these services, the water, sewer, fire protection, outweighed the potential negatives. And so they were comfortable with the interpretation that 49.70.1120 is a discretionary, these characteristics are discretionary, they're suggestions.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Ms. White.
Yes. I have to admit, at one point, I was very much in favor of this because I was thinking remote recreational properties, which I am familiar with. At some point, this turned into seasonal housing for people who will be working, I guess, in the visitor industry. Yet, I'm having a hard time envisioning all these people with no ways to shower, to do their laundry, and it's so you kind of, I guess I'm just trying to understand, when did this shift from remote recreational properties to seasonal housing?
It never did shift. I was just referencing the types of, and maybe I gave too much emphasis to one particular potential user of these parcels. It never did shift. That's what I can say about that.
Okay.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Warrow. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mr. Clark.
You're right.
You didn't make an impression.
It's up
to me. Thank you very much. Okay, so we'll close public comment. and we'll move on to the assembly action. Ms. Becker.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I move adoption of ordinance 2015-02 and ask for unanimous consent.
Okay.
Any objections?
Okay.
Mr. Jones.
I guess I need some answers. I don't know whether it's law or CDD. But part of the argument made is that there's already the precedent with Spoon Island. So I'm still not sure how that's a precedent, given it's an island not accessible by road where this could be. They opted to do other things. In conversations with Mr. Worrell and also at the public hearing at the Planning Commission on this, there were some homeowners out at the end of Douglas, North Douglas, the end of the road there, that is in a similar situation where they have no city utilities, have no city water, and feel that they've been sort of precluded from able to subdivide or do anything with their particular land because of some of these issues. Mr. Worrell basically says that's not an issue because the precedent's already been set with Spoon Island. I've never quite understood that, so I don't know whether that's a question that the attorney can clear up. Has there been a precedent? Are we dealing with precedent? Are we breaking precedent one way or the other on this?
Ms. Mead.
My understanding is that since the remote subdivision map ordinances were adopted, that this has only been applied to lots that are accessed by navigable water. There are other code sections that support that understanding that the intent behind this ordinance and the scheme with remote subdivisions was that they be accessible by navigable water. So really that is the question for the assembly now, is whether or not you want to continue with that policy and interpretation or go in a different direction. As far as what happened on Spoon Island and the specific policy decision that went into why that ended up the way that did, I think that's a better question answered by staff.
One more. Do we need to have CDD too?
One more sort of question then, I guess. Manager's report said that if we were to approve this tonight, we would need to amend, I guess, the subdivision ordinance that is being now reviewed and will be before us fairly soon.
So the new subdivision ordinance that's coming before you does embody the same, it carries forward the same intent, which is that remote subdivisions be accessed by navigable water. So depending on what you do tonight, that ordinance might need amending. There are two other code sections that I'm aware of in current code that might need addressing should you decide to move forward with this subdivision, with this map amendment, excuse me.
I have one more question then.
Mr. Jones.
If that's the case, then why wasn't that concept that the subdivision ordinance would need to be changed presented to the Planning Commission when they made their decision? Because in they're making their decision and they were in the process of reviewing the subdivision ordinance. The fact that they approved it and moved it forward to us, the issue was never raised that then they'd have to go look at the subdivision ordinance and change it by their action.
They had the subdivision ordinance though, so that's not something that we, but
well, they heard this application that's now before us and passed it on. Manager says if we now pass it, we may need to make amendments to the subdivision ordinance. Why wasn't that same information given to the Planning Commission in their decision to recommend to us? They could have then, through their subdivision review committee, presented to us how we could change that to support them. I'm not understanding why the Planning Commission wasn't informed of that.
My understanding is that the SRC, which is the Subdivision Review Committee, has specifically stated that they are waiting to hear what this assembly does with this ordinance before they look at that section. It may be that it doesn't need amending, or it may need amending, but they were waiting to hear what this body's policy decision was, so they're aware that that's in the ordinance.
Okay, anything else?
No, I'm not any more clear, but I got no more.
We need to get that completed and out of committee.
But it's got to be done right, Mr. Mayor.
It's sort of it, yeah.
It's got to be done, yeah. Ms. Troll.
Did you have your hand up? Okay. I am not in support of this motion because I think we have a choice here. We can try to fix the fact that we don't really have a subdivision that clearly articulates out land access remote recreation sites. We can either fix it by a new designation and ask the Community Development Department to, you know, come up with a designation that addresses the situation, because we have other situations out there on Douglas Island. Or we try and fix it by private covenant. And, I just think it's more incumbent upon us to solve the problems comprehensively than try to make this round peg fit in a square hole of, is it seasonal housing, is it recreation? When the remote designation was came first before us, it clearly states there, you know, now accessed by navigable water or not connected to a road system. This doesn't quite fit. It's an in-between. So we're trying to make this in-between situation fit into something that it was never envisioned to. And when we deal with land access remote subdivisions, we've not defined what the minimum right-of-way width should be. We've not defined the minimum roadway width. We've not defined the roadway surface type. I think we can do a better job of fixing the situation for Hidden Valley and all of the land access recreation sites better by not corrupting the current remote designation and make it work where it belongs. So I will not be supporting this, and if the motion fails, I'll come back with a second motion.
Thank you. Mr. Jones.
Thank you. It's funny how we all hear the same arguments and come up with totally different reasons. I was opposed to this going in. I think at this point I'm actually going to support it because I think it'll force us to look at the subdivision ordinance. I think if we don't do anything, Planning Commission is going to send the subdivision ordinance to us. We're going to be in the same boat. And if the manager's correct and we approve this tonight, then we have to take a look at it and it gets changed. That may or may not be in Mr. Worrell's favor as it comes up, and he may be stymied again based on however that's done. But if we turn it down, I just think that nothing will happen with the subdivision ordinance. It'll come before us. We won't understand what the fixes ought to be. We'll ignore it and pass the subdivision ordinance, and we'll be right back here the next time Mr. Worrell comes in. So I guess in that sense, I'm going to support this tonight. It's kind of convoluted, and I know Mr. Keel will not understand my logic, but that's okay.
Mr. Keel, you're
next. Well, thank you, Mr. Mayor. I understand Mr. Jones' logic. I'm going to encourage him to take it one more step and change his mind again, though. For a couple of reasons. I remain as concerned about this ordinance as I was at our last Lands Committee meeting. And one of the things that really does concern me is something Mr. Clark alluded to, and that's the future cost to the taxpayers who don't live in the new subdivision. That's one of the reasons we have the subdivision requirements that we do. Because once there are 23 or 25 homeowners out there with families and kids and what have you, there are a lot more folks in here asking for things to change. And we've seen that before. We've seen that in other neighborhoods in town, and then they come in at 90-10, 90% on the rest of the taxpayers and 10 on the folks who live there. And so, we do have – some standards that a person can use for a rural subdivision. And to me, the most important of those is the road standard. And for me, that's not, if we're looking 3 miles through a gravel extraction area, obviously we're not talking about a place for the kids to walk to school. What we're talking about is a place for the ambulance to go. Because I don't know if, I assume that this is outside the fire protection area, but I know we send the ambulance out to Sunshine Cove when somebody's bleeding, even if it's past the fire protection area. And that's the right thing to do. And a 16-foot crypto road is a recipe for having an ambulance out of service when the next person needs it because it's stuck. So I appreciate very much that the Planning Commission grappled with the question of whether this thing is a road or not, but I don't believe in pickup truck trails. I think if it's meant for a car to travel it, it's a road. And frankly, I think it's very appropriate that some past assembly looked at what it takes to get an ambulance there, or maybe even a police car. And they're not Lincolns these days, but they don't exactly. Most of them have 4-wheel drive. I will defer to the former police officer on the assembly about that question. I mentioned. And I guess, actually, just to finish that thought, I'm also concerned Mr. Worrell mentioned more property up the valley that might be good for the next set of remote. I don't know what we have now, cabin sites or starter homes or whichever scenario this is. But that gets to be more families and more kids. God forbid there needs to be an ambulance call. To that end, I'll return to Mr. Jones's logic about our subdivision ordinance. I don't think it's fair to any developer to have them keep spending money and keep putting out capital while we try and figure out whether we want to change our subdivision ordinance. We have plenty of reasons, good reasons, to move forward on it with all the speed we can and come to smart conclusions. But somebody's pending bankruptcy, God forbid, shouldn't be the prompt. We have enough reasons to do our work in a hurry as it is. And I think unless and until we start doing pickup truck trails all over the CBJ in lieu of roads, we need to render a decision on this one. And I think we need to turn down this map amendment.
Thank you, Ms. Gladachevsky.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. We're talking about the remote subdivision. Just the plain definition of the word remote means it's far and hard to get to. Mr. Worrell said this evening, access to our site is not difficult. It's not. They can get to Costco faster than I can get to Costco from my house. I'm concerned about other properties connected to the road. I mean, I agree with Mr. Keel, if you can drive on it with your pickup truck, it's a road. The Planning Commission, I went and got their minutes from their last time they discussed it, and they got very specific about what is a road, asking for the legal definition of a road, and they agreed that, you know, they understand it, that it means if it doesn't meet the legal definition, it's not a road. So they took the strict definition of road. If it's not 28 feet and have, you know, gutters on the side, it's not a road. I think if you can drive to Costco in 5 minutes, it's not remote. And I feel bad for Mr. Worrell, who spent so much time on this, and I'd like to see him be able to develop his property how he wants to. But I don't think it's remote subdivision. I think we need a new category, semi-remote. I don't know what it's called, but remote is for you get in your boat, it's far away, it's hard to get to. You have your standards are not as high. I'm afraid it's on a road. People are going to, in a few years, say we want X and Y and Z. And I know they say they won't do it, but they do it again and again, and we hear it here in the assembly. So, and then the CBJ picks up 9% of the cost. So I don't think I don't think it's remote, so I'm going to not going to be supporting this.
Thank you. Ms. Crane.
Just a quick comment. I've been all over the map on this particular issue. I've been opposed to it. I thought I'd favored it. I've been opposed to it again. I come back to the issue of the road, which was a real concern to me. But I hate to tell Mr. Keel, my logic runs somewhere along the line of Mr. Jones, where I think that there may be fixes needed here as we go forward. And there is also the fact that even if we pass this, for this subdivision to go forward, they are still going to have to come back to the Planning Commission several times to go forward with this. And so we may be grappling with this again, no matter what we do. And like Mr. Jones, I think maybe this is the time to deal with some of this subject and go forward with it. So after a lot of waffling back and forth, today, finally, I came down on the positive side of it. And I share the concerns that are expressed here because I think they're very valid concerns. But I'm prepared tonight to vote yes.
Thank you, Ms. Crane. Ms. Becker? Do you have anything?
Thank you. I just was going to make a comment to, I don't remember who said it, but we have a lot of places that did not have CPJ Road with us doing it that who have come to us and won it. We just did one the other night, long after they didn't want a road. Now they want a road, they want us to fix it. This project is going to have covenants that is going to protect us from that. There's no guarantee for what it's going to be 30 years from now, but the intent is to not allow that. And that, to me, gives me comfort for what this is going to be. So I am in support of this project.
Mr. Dan Curvis?
I don't have much comments. I'd just like to call the question, if I may.
Okay. The question before us is, shall Ordinance 2015-02 be accepted? And we have objection still? Good. Madam Clerk?
Crane?
Yes.
Mr. Jones?
Yes.
Ms. Bartoszewski?
No.
Mr. Keel?
No.
Mr. Nankervis?
Yes.
Ms. Troll?
No.
Ms. White?
Yes.
Ms. Becker?
Yes.
Mayor Sanford?
Yes. So, Ordinance 2015-02 has passed, and we don't have to take any action on that other stuff yet. You'll bring us before us?
Well, there is going to have to be, there is still the provision in 4915 that prohibits a remote subdivision without either access by navigable water or 30-foot right-of-way. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be an issue. Again, it's the same policy question that you're going to need to answer that I think Mr. Jones was alluding to. That's going to have to be answered before this project can go forward.
And so if we have changes that have to be answered, you'll form them up in an ordinance change or something like that for us?
I would need the policy direction first before I could know what you want embodied in the ordinance. So.
Okay. We'll talk about it in the interim and then figure out the exact direction we need to go from here to move forward on this one way or the other. Okay. Madam Clerk, please read the next item on the agenda, which is Ordinance 2014-24AF.
An ordinance appropriating $1,500 as partial funding to send one CBJ employee to the Managing Floodplain Development Course through the National Flood Insurance Program and Certified Floodplain Managers Exam. Grant funding provided by the State of Alaska Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development.
Thank you. Madam Manager, administrative report.
I think the title says most of it. I just will add that this will result in a second CBJ certified floodplain manager and that the cost that is provided, the $1,500 that is provided, covers the cost for the travel, but we had to pay was the cost of the of taking the exam itself. I recommend this ordinance be adopted.
Thank you. Public comment. Is there anybody in the public who wishes to comment on ordinance 2014-24AF? Seeing none, public comment is closed. Assembly action, Ms. Bartoszewski.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I move ordinance 2014-24AF and ask you for unanimous consent.
Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Madam Clerk, 2014-24AG.
An ordinance appropriating $67,146 as bond interest accrued within CIP H51-084, a fund for Douglas Harbor Improvements Phase 3.
Thank you, Madam Manager. Cabinet report.
This project was jointly funded by the CBJ and the Army Corps of Engineers. The Corps recently completed their project closeout, which indicates CBJ owns the Corps $10,103.50 for its match requirement of the project. The account also currently has a deficit of $10,649.74 due to under-budgeted bond service charges. Once this appropriation is complete, there would be a remaining $46,391.84 in the account. Dockson Harbors requests the remaining funds be transferred to the Harbor's deferred maintenance account for use in the upcoming Old Douglas Harbor rebuild, which is the transfer that will be addressed after this ordinance. The Public Works and Facilities Committee recommended this appropriation during their meeting on February 9th. The Dockson Harbors Board recommended this appropriation during their meeting on February 26th. I recommend this ordinance be adopted.
Thank you, Madam Manager. Is there anybody from the public who wishes to comment on ordinance 2014-24AG? Seeing none, public comment is closed. We'll move to assembly action. Mr. Nankervis.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I move adoption of ordinance 2014-24AG, and I ask for unanimous consent.
Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. We'll move forward to ordinance 2015-04.
Excuse me. We need to do the transfer. Sorry.
Up ahead. I've got it written down. So before us, we have transfer TE-967. Is there any objections to that being completed?
We need a motion.
Do we need a motion on it? Mr. Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I move approval of transfer T-967 and ask unanimous consent.
Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Madam Clerk, please read ordinance 2015-04.
An ordinance establishing the Engineering and Public Works Department.
Thank you. Madam Manager, admin report.
This ordinance will codify the December 2014 merger of the Departments of Engineering and Public Works. This organizational change was implemented for the purpose of increasing operational efficiencies, improving customer service, and reducing the overall cost of providing services. References in the code to either engineering or public works as separate entities will be amended to reference the one department and director as part of the overall code cleanup and republication being conducted by the Municipal Code Corporation. And that, I recommend this ordinance be adopted.
Thank you, Madam Manager. Is there anybody from the public who wishes to comment on this ordinance? Seeing none, public comment is closed. Assembly action. Ms. Crane.
I move adoption of ordinance 2015-04 and ask for unanimous consent.
Is there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. And we'll move forward, Madam Clerk, to ordinance 2015-08C.
An ordinance amending the official zoning map of the city and borough to change the zoning of 27 parcels along the North Douglas Highway between 4601 and 5295 North Douglas Highway from D3 to D5 and from RR transitional D3 to D15.
Thank you, Madam Clerk. Madam Manager, administrative report.
In December 2013, the Community Development Department initiated a rezone of 43 parcels along North Douglas Highway extending from mile 1.3 to mile 1.9. The parcels were identified at that time as transitional zones, rural reserve transition to D3, rural reserve transition to D15, and D1 transition to D3. On June 25th, 2014, staff held an informational meeting to discuss the proposed rezoning with all property owners in the affected area. No one from the public participated in the meeting. The Planning Commission heard the rezone proposal at its August 26, 2014 regular meeting. The Planning Commission recommended approving the rezone with modifications, upzoning a portion of the lots currently zoned from D1 transition D3 to D5, and a portion of the lots zoned rural reserve transition D3 to D15. The Planning Commission believed the modifications were needed for consistency with the land use maps of the comprehensive plan. Ordinance 2015-45 was forwarded to the Assembly with the Planning Commission's recommendations. Based on public testimony at the October 20, 2014 Assembly meeting, the Assembly remanded proposed Ordinance 2014-45 to the Planning Commission to solicit further public feedback and explore opportunities for higher densities. The rezone was re-noticed for the November 25, 2015 Planning Commission hearing. Based on public testimony at the hearing, the Planning Commission reversed its earlier decision to recommending upzoning of any of the parcels except for two located at 4605 and 4765 North Douglas Highway. Per CBJ 4970-700-720, once the Assembly has created a transition zone, the rezone occurs upon the Planning Commission's granting the rezone to the transitional zone designation. Accordingly, as the Planning Commission reversed its October 2014 decision to recommend upzoning 41 of the 43 parcels under consideration, as to those 41 parcels, the rezone of 40 parcels to D3 and one to D15 was completed. CBJ 4970-72-722-BA. At its meeting on February 23, 2015, the Assembly directed that the ordinance be amended to upzone all parcels originally identified in Ordinance 2014-45 for upzoning. This ordinance reflects that direction. Including your packet is a table illustrating the original zoning, current zoning, and proposed zoning of all 43 parcels originally identified in Ordinance 2014-45. The 27 parcels that are subject of this ordinance are indicated in your packet with the asterisk. I recommend this ordinance be adopted.
Thank you, Madam Manager. I see that we have only one person signed up, Ms. Robin Paul. Is there more than one person who wishes to speak? Okay, so we're going to take a five-minute break for a potty break here, and if you would come up and sign in on the form. We're in recess for 5 minutes. And we are at the position of public comment. And we have four or five people signed up now. So we'll, again, have 3 minutes each. And we have, first of all, Ms. Robin Paul.
We cut you off before you got there.
That was just not fair.
That's just not fair.
You know anybody? You know anybody who does tech stuff who could fix that, Robin?
What was that?
You know anybody who does tech stuff who could fix that?
Oh yes, yeah. We can do that. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Robin Paul, and I live at 5025 North Douglas. This is the third time I've been in this room about this particular issue. The first time, I'm embarrassed to say, I was at the August 26th meeting before the Planning and Zoning Commission, and the only reason I was there was because I couldn't figure out where 1.3 through 1.9 mile North Douglas is. I live at 5025. I was told that I'm measured from City Hall. So I really did not know where 1.3 to 1.9 mile North Douglas was. I had to come and find out. It never dawned on me that the zoning was going, the issue that night was going from D1 to D3 because we have sewer and water now to D5. Not focused, didn't hear it, was in my own little world of what land is affected by this change. And so you, the Assembly, for some reason, decided that there wasn't a public process about the recommendation from the Planning and Zoning, and you sent it back to them. That's when I got my attention to that we were changing to D5. And I will say that I totally support the addition of housing, more housing in Juneau. I was delighted to see the article on the front page of today's newspaper saying that there was a complex, a 13-home complex, going to be before the Planning and Zoning Committee for this project, and it is at 5405 North Douglas. It's just past the area that we're talking about tonight. And so I Googled it and did the street view. Oh, my goodness, that lot, one road up to this area, they've got over 3 acres, 13 homes, one road coming down, clear, beautiful line of sight, either direction from that location. Which brings me to several points you said tonight. Safety, this remote site that we were talking about in Lemon Creek. One of the big concerns you had tonight was safety issue. How are people there going to be looked after if we need to get an ambulance out there or whatever happens? Well, my concern and why I object to this change to from D3 to D5 is that this corner where I live is very, very dangerous. The posted speed limit is 45 miles an hour. North Douglas, driving home tonight, it dawned on me how many roads come off or driveways come off, and North Douglas is not a highway anymore. This speed limit, the traffic, the increase in the density on that corner right by the trailer court, the line of sight issue is really, really bad. It's very scary. And I think this is the wrong thing to do. Is that a buzzer that I have to quit? Darn, yep. I was just getting warmed up.
Just when you get going.
Just when I was getting
any
warmed up.
Any questions for Ms. Paul? Thank you very much for coming down again.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Stitt.
Good evening, everyone.
Thank you for coming down again.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah. Hand out to everyone.
Four. All right.
Can I pop one heading? No.
Yeah. No.
You have to talk
into the mic. Oh,
that's
right.
Here, I can handle
it. Just, we can pass them out. You can.
Did you play? Whatever your time. And I'm going to have to talk really fast because 3 minutes goes by in a hurry. Send it to them.
Thank you.
My name is Cody Stitz, 5065 North Douglas Highway. And before I get started, Mr. Chairman, could I have could I ask for a point of clarification because it's really important. Would someone actually be able to confirm for me that the rezone that we're talking about tonight was actually finalized by the Planning Commission on November the 25th, and that what's actually happening tonight is a whole nother rezone moving us from D3 to D5. I think that's a very important point.
Ms. Keeper? Ms. Mead?
Any of the lots that had been D1 transition to D3, anything that went to the transition designation that had been originally indicated in the transition zone happened as a matter of course after the Planning Commission hearing?
So my house in particular was one of those that was D1 to D3.
If your house was D1 transition D3, the transition to D3 has occurred.
And it's fully completed?
Correct.
Okay. And so really the matter before us tonight is moving 27 parcels from D3 to D5.
Correct. 25 parcels, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. I just wanted to make sure that was extremely clear because it's really important. So on February the 25th, two parcels came before you that were part of the original assembly, part of the original ordinance that went before you. And Mr. Nankervis called it a bouncing bunny that just never goes away, which surprised me because he voted in favor of reintroducing these 27 lots to migrate them from D3 to D5, because this issue was completely solved by the Planning Commission. So, and they heard it and finished it on November the 25th. So now that we're re-talking about this, what we're really talking about is a whole nother rezone that was initiated by the Assembly, not initiated as was originally discussed. So, and as I listen to the tape, two things come out, that you need to pay for sewer and water, and we need increased housing to lower housing costs. And just for full disclosure, when I found out that this was being reintroduced, literally 90 days after the Planning Commission just finalized it, three of us landowners got together and we collectively hired an attorney. Mr. Dan Bruce is representing us. He did his assessment of this and has come to the conclusion that what you're attempting to do, literally 90 days after the Planning Commission finalized it, is has no legal basis and is absolutely inappropriate.
Mr. Stitt, you can go another minute.
If I may have an extension, I would really appreciate
it. One more minute, yes.
Thank you. So that's really concerning. And as I look at this, I would like to point out that the only curve on all of North Douglas is in front of our house. And the Planning Commission said that. Two of them live out there, and they gave personal testimony as to how dangerous this curve was. And that's why they recommended staying at D3. The topo for the area is absolutely inhospitable to development. Even if he wanted to put D5 there, there's no way it would be developable. And then, since you're talking about moving me from D3 to D5, I'd like to point out that here and here, just further down the road, you have two sections of medium density residential. And for some reason, our neighborhood was isolated as saying, you, of all places, we're going to take assembly action and say, you need to go from D3 to D5. When there's clearly two sections of MDR that are literally a mile from our house, and you did nothing with them. So of all the places in Juneau that you would literally initiate your own rezone from the assembly level, you're going to handpick my neighborhood, my tiny little 25 homes, and say, you, of all places, have to go D3 to D5. There's not a single point of no one north of the bridge is zoned D5. Yet, you're singling out a curve in the road on an inhospitable topographic area to say, you need to go D3 to D5. When you passed up flat land MDR, where you could have gone to D15, I find it really hard to believe. And then to add insult to injury, if you go to the back page, this one right here, this is RRP to D3, that's 200 acres of city-owned land. That's land you own. There is no recommendation to upzone any of this land.
Mr. Stitt, I have to cut you off here. Is there any questions for Mr. Stitt?
I would be happy to answer questions. I would appreciate a little dialogue because I think this is really important.
Go through me, Mr. Stitt.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Boss up here today. Thank you. Okay, any questions for Mr. Stitt? Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate it. The next person to testify is Pamela Garcia. Welcome, Ms. Garcia.
Thank you, Mayor Sanford and Assembly. I live at 5045 North Douglas, just right near Robin and Cody Stitz. And I'm just here to reiterate our concerns. I'm supporting what they just said, that we were here in November and the Planning Commission heard our comments and they reversed. They changed their mind from going from D1 to D5 and kept it at the original plan for D3. And that was based on the concern with safety, because it is a really dangerous curve right there. And, out of all the places in North Douglas, it's probably the worst place that you want to create higher density. So I just wanted to remind the Assembly that. And it seemed kind of odd to us that the Planning Commission had made a decision and now it's reversed. So anyway, don't do it. It's dangerous.
I don't know if you're the best person or if the community development director, but there's also some zoning that went in that's R15 zoning on the D15, sorry.
Okay.
And and where is that in relationship to the curve? Were there safety concerns about that upzone?
One of the D15 lots, I believe, is behind where Mike Hatch places the gravel pit there, and that's beyond the curve on the other side of the curve, so you actually have more visibility, and it's just naturally like flatter land where you could just see that you can develop it. Like Cody said, a lot of the properties on the curve, they're very steep, and doesn't even seem like you would develop it. And there's like narrow little driveways that go in to the main highway. And it really is dangerous. Like half the time in the winter, you're just holding your breath and hoping and praying that you're not going to slide into a car when you go down your driveway. So it's not a good idea to create more density in that area. There are better areas in North Douglas, and some of those areas are already D15 and already zoned, like what was in the article that Robin mentioned, and they're like past us, and there is no curve, and you can see both ways when you come down your driveway, and it's not quite as steep either. So that little area right now it's a bad area to create more density in. It's pretty unsafe. Yeah.
Any other questions?
Thanks for listening.
Okay. Ms. Becker, one more.
Oh.
Don't leave me.
Oh.
Are the areas that the three of you specifically are talking mm-hmm. about tonight, are they the ones that are being rezoned? Are they private? Or do you own them? That the lot that's being rezoned, do you own those three?
Yeah, we're the owners.
Okay. Yeah. So how can going to D5 become more dangerous if you don't do anything differently than what you're doing right now?
Well, because it's not just us three. There's, 25 lots that are being considered to be rezoned to D5. So
I was just thinking the three of you own the ones that rezoned.
Right, but we're just thinking of for posterity. There's other land around us, and we don't know who the owners are. I don't know who all the owners are, and maybe they would want to develop. It's not a good area to create higher density. There's other areas. It's really unsafe there. Narrow driveways, curve. It's icy. It's terrible in the wintertime.
Any other questions? Thank you, Ms. Garcia. Patty Collins? just want to.
All right, my name.
Be careful both. Thank you.
My name's Patty Collins. I own property at 5300 North Douglas Highway. It's one lot just past this little area. I share a driveway with my neighbor, who would be the last lot on the water side in this curved area. Before I owned this piece of property, I lived in the trailer park, which would be at the beginning of this little section that we're talking about. My concern isn't having more people. I know that there's a housing crunch in Juneau, but North Douglas Highway has, this is the steepest curve with a hill in this little section. All the driveways have really short line of sights. The driveway, you know, the trailer park, winter or summer, anybody coming from the north, you have to book it as soon as you decide to drive out on North Douglas Highway, or else you will get rear-ended, really. You got to move fast. The driveway that I share with my neighbor right now, once the snow berms are up, I have about a two-car line of sight. So I come up from low, hope that it's a do-you-feel-lucky moment all winter long for me, Russian roulette. You know, I come up from below. Am I going to make it? When I see a car, I have to slam on my brakes, and then I slide back down until I can try again. So sure, people that own the property might not develop, but then again, they might. And it's just how many cars are coming in and out of those driveways and how many do you really want in those sections. You got a straightaway before that from the bridge to that corner. It's pretty straight. It's not as tight. You got straightaways after that. If you're going to have higher distance density on North Douglas Highway, I just recommend picking a straighter part of the road. That's it.
Thank you, Ms. Thanks. Collins. Any questions for Ms. Collins? Seeing none, thank you very much, ma'am. And we have Mr. Stephen M.
Merley.
Oh, Merley. Hi. Welcome.
Thanks. I'm Steve Merley. I live at 5045 North Douglas. And I'd just like to reiterate that it's one of the more unsafe places you could drive on Douglas. And I think what everybody has just said is sufficient enough. I just want to say that I think it should stay at D3. Putting more people in there trying to access that road out of driveways is really a scary proposition, especially people coming up from downhill, as the last speaker was speaking of. I watch that road all the time, people trying to get out of that trailer park, and you can just tell right on that turn, it is. Now, you just have to go out there and hope you don't get hit. So, as a matter of safety and all of our consciousness here, I would much prefer it to stay at D3, right in that place where it doesn't need any more density. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. Okay, that's the last person I have signed up on the list for this one. What is, I'll close public comment. What is the wishes of the assembly? Mr. Keith.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I move adoption of ordinance serial number 2015-08C and ask unanimous consent.
I object.
Locking mic.
All right, we have objection. Mr. Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I appreciate the testimony that was tonight. We as an assembly had this before us to create a D5. We sent it back to the Planning Commission. They acted. They held another hearing. I sat through the hearing. Most of these individuals testified at that hearing. The Planning Commission opted to take all of the parcels that were going to D5 to only D3, which was sort of the request of the landowners that testified before the Planning Commission. As I understand the legal issue, That ended the issue. It didn't have to come back to us at all, except for the two going to D15. Came before us, and the Assembly supported an amendment to go back to the D5 that was in the original before we sent it back to the Planning Commission. And I objected at that time, and I maintain that objection. I think that the thing that we can do to we sent it back to the Planning Commission, they acted, the homeowners have come before us, they came before the Planning Commission, and I think in honor of that, I have to vote no on this. If we have to, maybe we need some direction from the attorney on how we might amend this to include the rural remote transition to D3 to D15, or we have to come back in a separate ordinance later. But for right now, the way this ordinance C is done, I have to vote no.
Thank you. Mr. Jones, any comments on reference?
Just to, if I understood correctly, Mr. Jones, your question was if you wanted to move forward with the upzoning to the D15 for the two RRT D3 lots, how would that be accomplished?
Yes, because that was basically the original ordinance that came before us before we amended it to include all these others to D5.
So it would just be another amendment to remove all of the proposed rezones except for those two.
We can't revert back to 2015-08B.
That's in essence what it would be doing, but you would just direct that there would be a motion to amend the ordinance to make that change, and then that change is what would be adopted.
Thank you. Ms. Craig.
Well, this evening was the first time I'd heard that there's a legal issue here.
I do not agree with Mr. Bruce's analysis. He cited to a Washington case, and his analysis of the Washington case was that in Washington, legislative rezone decisions are presumed not valid, along with some other findings. In Alaska, actually, rezones are legislative decisions that are presumed to be valid. If someone wants to challenge that legislative decision, they would do so under a complaining that the legislative decision was arbitrary or capricious, and we would have to show a rational basis. There, you've articulated a basis for doing so, so if that's what you choose to do, I believe that the ordinance is valid. There's no procedural problem with how we got to where we are now, which was something that Mr. Stitz alluded to. But I do not think that I don't agree with Mr. Bruce's analysis.
Thank you.
Mr. Keel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Mayor. To add on to what the city attorney said, I think that I got an email from Mr. Bruce. I don't know whether we all did or not, but I think he has a serious timeline problem. And Mr. Stitz suggested that the purpose of this rezone is somehow to pay for infrastructure, and the timeline's upside down. The infrastructure is there. $13.4 million of infrastructure is there, running sewer lines north from basically from the bridge. It's in, and you know, a tremendous amount of it came from the state. There's four, looks like five, oh, higher math. Looks like $5.5 million, almost $6 million of CBJ money in that sewer project. Those sewer projects. I don't want to give the impression they're all right out in front of these 25 parcels. It's not. But I think that that was done for a number of very important public policy reasons. Chief among them, in my mind, is enabling more housing along North Douglas Highway. And I certainly would hope that this is not the only area that goes up D3 toward D5. I know that there's area immediately adjacent to near the bridge that's gone up to D18. I think the D15s are excellent progress in this direction. But the single biggest purpose of $13.4 million of city and state money was for more housing without the environmental impacts of more septic systems that tend to have problems in Southeast. So I am particularly sensitive to the safety concerns. I don't like that curve either. And I know that the driveways on it now, the folks are unhappy with them. I don't know whether D5 is high enough density for people over time to renegotiate their driveway agreements with one another or to justify changing the alignment of a driveway. I do know that any additional driveways are going to have to get through the State Department of Transportation, which does look at sight lines and safety. And I think that as part of, not all, part of the increased zoning density that we're going to allow, not require, but allow out North Douglas, these lots are, I think, one of the steps. Not because I think everybody's going to suddenly have 5 units an acre on them, but because it allows for more housing to go in over time as the property owners can find a way to do it. So I'm speaking strongly in favor of the motion.
Thank you, Mr. Keel. Ms. Troll.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I too try to look at this issue from increasing housing availability, upzoning for higher density. So I got into looking at the Planning Commission notes and all that and kind of learned some things that popped out at me, which was, you know, in a D3 zone on the same size lot, you're more likely to have a duplex. In a D5 zone, you can't have a duplex. And so I asked the Planning Commission or the community development staff, what's the density difference between zoning all this D3 versus zoning at D5 and assuming everybody went to their maximum level? And it was only a difference of 9 possible units. So for 43 lots that were rezoning to make that much of a difference of impact, and it's because of the nuances between the D3 and D5. It's not, in other words, it's not an automatic conversion of, oh, yeah, D5 means there's going to be a much more significant higher density. It doesn't equate quite that way. So once I realized the density factor wasn't that great, then I kind of went back and looked at, well, what were the reasons for the Planning Commission to vote 6-1 for this? Because they, too, have been very keen and very interested in increasing affordable housing and have, you know, made significant upzones around the region for that purpose. And what comes out is they're concerned about the safety and the traffic issues that we heard to this evening on the road. And it just seems to me that there's more appropriate places for us to look at D5 zoning on North Douglas than in its attachment to this curve. So the gain we would make by going from D3 to D5 didn't seem to be significant enough in my mind to warrant the additional traffic risk. And I also know that the Planning Commission is just as concerned about affordable housing as I am, and they voted 6-1 because of that overriding traffic safety concern. So I'm going to vote against this motion for those reasons and hope that we will look at more appropriate places in North Douglas, where the line of sight does lend itself to D5 zoning.
Thank you, Ms. Troll. Ms. White, then Ms. Gladys-Jeff.
Yes, I'm actually still in favor of this because I've been through the subdivision process and the road process a few times myself. I do know that DOT does look at the driveway permits. They go visit the site. They look at the topography. They look at the line of sight. One of mine was approved to go direct from the road. One of them was not for these same type of safety concerns. This is not forcing anybody to subdivide their property. It's giving an option if other conditions warrant that it's available. As Ms. Troll said, it does increase the possibility of having duplexes. But another issue that we were looking at had to do with child care facilities, and I don't have the table of permissible uses in front of me, but there was a significant difference on what you could do with D3 versus D5 zoning. And so it wasn't just housing that we were looking at this, and I, like I said, I don't, I didn't want to, like, start pulling out my electronic devices and things. But there are enough other fail safes there for us to protect us as far as, like, looking at the safety of the curve, the safety of the road. Granted, North Douglas has got to be one of the darkest, scariest roads to drive at night. If I lived on that road, I'd be petitioning the state for some lighting. But I'm still in favor of this just because I think it just gives the options of proceeding.
Thank you. Ms. White, Ms. Podolsky.
Mr. Mayor, can I ask Mr. Hart a question?
Mr. Hart, you've gotten away without us getting you up here today. Thank you, Mr. Hart.
Thank you, Mr. Hart. Can you respond to what Ms. Troll said about duplexes and number of extra units? And
yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah. Is
more duplexes, fewer duplexes, not allowed?
Let me preface this, that there's a number of things that you can look at that we probably don't look at the finer scale. One of them would be this PUD. Second one might be bungalow. Third one might be duplex standards, and how they would apply on a lot-by-lot basis within that specific area. So I believe on the duplex issue that we've said that right this evening. So
say it for me, Si.
Yeah, I'm looking at Beth on that one because we've talked about it a little bit. But come on, Beth. Sorry. Just want to make sure we've got the right information in front of you. But
if I might, at the Planning Commission when this came up, if I remember correctly, Ms. McGibbon went through the differences between D3 and D5 of what's allowable and what's not allowable. I was surprised at how much is actually allowable in the D3, other than single family, that wouldn't be allowable in the D5, and what was allowable.
Okay.
And like I think Ms. Troll said, it's almost like a wash, and I couldn't quite figure out what the big issue was. So.
Ms. McGibbon, thank you.
Duplexes are allowed both in D3 and D5 zoning district.
Okay.
In both.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
So
okay.
And is it the assertion that with these 29 lots we'd only get 9 more units? Is that based on anything? That is.
I don't know. You would have to look at the acreage. There are a couple things that might impact that, how much road frontage they are, how steep they are, if they were large enough to subdivide. Depending on how the access might be provided, if they were able to be divided into multiple lots or if they'd have to be panhandled, they could be combined into lots could be combined and re-subdivided. So there's a lot of variables that you can't really account for based on just calculating acreage.
Does topography get in there too at times later?
It does, because we have requirements for how steep driveways and roads can be.
Any other questions?
Any development as far as driveways has to go through driveway siteability and all of that. I mean,
the lots that directly access the highway have to get driveway permits from the Department of Transportation, but if they were to subdivide or develop a property, I heard someone refer to 13 units. That's a planned unit development in D3. That they're getting a driveway permit from DOT to access the highway, but the construction of the access within the PUD is through our office, and there are restrictions for how steep that can be, primarily for fire access.
Thank you.
Any other questions for staff? Any other comments? And we have any other comments? Thank you. And we have before us ordinance 2015-08C. We still have the objection. Mr. Jones, still objection?
Thank you, Ms. Mayor. Yes, I still maintain my objections. I'm not sure if this is going to be worded right, but I would move to amend the motion that on the ordinance on page 3, that on line 8, 6D07010103030, down through line 25, 6D07010800010 be deleted.
Could you state that again, please?
Yeah, on the page. Basically, the motion I'm making is, I guess it's line 8 through line 25. The third line down in that table through the last line, that those be deleted. All of those are the D3s that are going to D5. I just recommend that they be deleted because I believe that's what we added to this ordinance. That would take us back to the original B version.
Mind check.
Ms.
Troll, go ahead.
Question. When you say take us back to the B version, you're talking about the version, which version is that? The version that originally came, I thought that what this is here is the version we got originally from the Planning Commission.
No, it is not.
Yes, it is.
We were presented.
Almost, it is.
Yeah. We were presented with an ordinance from that came basically on the actions of the Planning Commission, who we sent back.
Right.
What came back to us was a version B that the...
I'm talking about the one that the Planning Commission originally sent to us.
You guys talk through me.
Sorry.
It's okay.
I guess I'm not explaining it well, but what was brought before us in version B included the rezone of the RRT D3s, and that was it, with the statement from law that the action of the Planning Commission by staying within the D3, it did not bring it to us. That became version B of this ordinance. We then amended it to come up with version C. I'm trying to get back to that version B, and my understanding is if you remove all of the D3s to D5, you're back to what the manager and law department said was the only appropriate action sent to us from the Planning Commission at that time.
Thank you. Any other comments, questions on the amendment, Ms. Stroll? Ms. Bledis-Jepsky?
Object. I. All of these rezones are always difficult. We all say we want more housing options in this town, and then when the difficult decisions come, there are always neighbors that object, and we have a limited amount of land in this town. We have very, very limited amount of industrial land, commercial land, residential land, and we can't afford to develop it in the way we've developed it in the past. So this would remove the original Planning Commission's recommendation, included these recommendations, and I would like to stick to the original Planning Commission's recommendations.
Thank you, Ms. Klawczewski. Any other comments? Okay, before us is amendment number one to ordinance 2015-8C. We have objection. Madam Clerk, please read the roll.
Ms. Becker?
No.
Ms. Crane?
No.
Mr. Jones?
Yes.
Ms. Bledis-Jepsky?
No.
Mr. Keel?
No.
Mr. Nankervis?
No.
Ms. Troll?
Yes.
Ms. White?
No.
Mayor Sanford?
No.
Motion fails.
Thank you. We have before us the original motion to adopt 2015-08C. Do we still have a...
Objection, yes. Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. Any other comments or questions on this? Move forward. Ms. Beth, will you please read the roll?
On the question of ordinance 2015-08C, Ms. Becker?
Yes.
Ms. Crane?
Yes.
Mr. Jones?
No.
Ms. Gladyszewski?
Yes.
Mr. Keel?
Yes.
Mr. Nankervis?
Yes.
Ms. Troll?
No.
Ms. White?
Yes.
Mayor Sanford?
Yes.
Motion passes.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. We will move forward to our next ordinance, which is ordinance 2015-18. Madam Clerk.
An ordinance establishing the Treadwell Arena Advisory Board.
Thank you. Madam Manager, Administrative Report.
The Treadwell Ice Arena Task Force was established by the Assembly in August 2014.
The task force was asked to report on the feasibility of an empowered board to reduce costs and provide services through management by the Eagle Crest Ski Area Board. The feasibility of an empowered board to reduce costs and provide services through an alternate to the management of Eagle Crest Ski Area Board, and review alternate management structures for managing the Treadwell Arena. The task force recommended that a Treadwell Arena Advisory Board be created. The Assembly Human Resources Committee reviewed the task force recommendations and directed staff to develop an ordinance creating a Treadwell Arena Advisory Board. The Human Resources Committee considered the ordinance at its March 16, 2015 meeting and recommended board to the Assembly for Assembly approval. I recommend this ordinance be adopted.
Thank you, Madam Manager. I'll open this up for public comment. We have one person signed up. Is there anybody else besides Ms. Collins that wishes to testify on this ordinance? Seeing none, Ms. Collins, you're the only one. Welcome.
All right. So my name is Patty Collins, and I'm here as a representative of the Juneau Skating Club, for which I am a board member. The Juneau Skating Club is very glad that the Assembly is making progress on this matter, and we hope to do our part to help ensure Treadwell's success and longevity and have it be something that's as cost-effective as possible for the Assembly and for our city. We do have concerns about, let's see, it starts with page one, very last line, no more than two members shall be employees or board members or the immediate family member or an employee or board member of any organization that provides activities at the Treadwell Ice Arena. I've spoken with Lauren, and you know, her opinion that she's expressed to me is the best way to turn light users into regular users is to get them involved with the programs. And 80% of the users of Treadwell are users of one of the five main programs of that facility. And this limits basically two seats, people that would have intimate knowledge of these programs. So it's our belief that it's in your best interest to make sure that you have the greatest pool possible to choose from. And you will be able to assure that you'll have a nice, well-rounded pool to choose, or a nice, well-rounded board, by the fact that you ultimately do decide who sits on that advisory board. So, the Juneau Skating Club really does recommend that you remove that last line and leave yourself more options and have your vested users being able to be on that board. Worst case scenario, we just really don't want to see you have a board of people that don't have enough knowledge to help out with what you have set aside as the tasks for this board, and that's to grow the user base, grow the revenues for that facility. So, and if you do choose to keep the wording the same as this ordinance has, we really would like to understand, you know, why you feel it's in the best interest of the public to limit those seats to just two board members.
Thank you, Ms. Collins. Any questions for Ms. Collins? Mr. Jones?
Thank you. I believe we also received an email or a letter from the Hockey Association also questioning whether this was an appropriate limit. So absent your recommendation, which is to remove this sentence, mm-hmm. Would changing the number, because I understand, I think Treadwell, there's five separate sort of skating organizations?
There's three clubs that operate five programs using four boards. Does that make sense?
Yeah. If I do the math. So would changing the two to a three be...
That'd be a step in the right direction. I think it'd be even better to move the two to a five.
But I understand what you...
Yeah, but that would be a step in the right direction.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Any other questions for Ms. Collins? Thank you very much for staying, Ms. Collins, and being with us today. Okay, we'll close public. Since nobody else signed up, we will close public comment. We'll move to Assembly action. Mr. Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I would move approval of ordinance serial number 2015-18 and would like to speak to two amendments, if I might.
Thank you, Mr. Jones.
Mayor, I would move as a First Amendment, page one, last line, no more than two, that we change two to three, and would ask unanimous consent.
Is there any objections? Mr. Nankervis.
I guess I don't have an objection, Mr. Mayor. I do have a question, though. And I understand Ms. Collins' comments, and as a frequent flyer over there myself, I think what you're looking at here, specifically, and Mr. Jones probably knows this, is two hockey groups and one skating group, figure skating group. And I don't know that I would want, even though I'm the hockey side of that, not the figure skating side, I'm not sure that I would want there to be three hockey people on there, or two hockey people and one skating. To me, it just seems more appropriate that you don't overload, you don't have the possibility to overload it, I guess. And that's my cause of concern with changing the numbers, and I think the numbers are fairly consistent with what we've done at other boards like Eagle Crest. We limit their number of board members that can be in programs up there. So I'm just not necessarily objecting to it yet. I might get there, but I just think folks need to have that out there, and I do understand Ms. Collins' comments, but I'm not sure about that.
Thank you, Mr. Nankervis. Mr.
Keefe. I guess, Mr. Mayor, I share Mr. Nankervis's nerves about it a little bit. I had not thought about it in terms of number of figure skaters versus hockey advocates, or rather board members in particular. My own thought about limiting the number of board members of user groups is that it helps us ensure that the primary focus of the board is the breadth of users, and that it really maintains, it preserves a strong focus on the public who are not necessarily part of any given club. And so I that's the other thing that gives me nerves about raising the number of board members of user groups above our standards. Certainly, I expect everybody will be a user. But when you get into board members of particular groups, the interests can become more specialized.
Okay, we've got before us a change from two to three. Is there any objections now?
Yeah, I object.
All right.
Can I just understand? I heard that. Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
That there was four boards, and now you said there's three boards. How many boards are there?
Well,
skating boards.
I'm not sure how many there are figure skating, but there's adult hockey and then there's youth hockey. There's the two hockey boards in the high school. I don't know if they have a board or what they call it, but there's another group. Ms. Collins could probably state it a lot cleaner than I did.
She said there were five groups, four boards.
Mm-hmm. Five programs.
Ms. Collins, go ahead.
So there's three clubs. There's adult hockey, youth hockey, and the Juno Skating Club. The Juno Skating Club operates two programs. It's the figure skating program and the basic skills learn to skate program, which is a feeder program for all of the programs, including your recreational skaters who usually don't ever fit into any program at all. They usually end up being light users. JDIA, the youth hockey organization, they have two boards, one that operates the under high school aged program, and then the Blue Line Club, which falls under JDIA, is the board for the high school hockey team. They're mostly a fundraising board, but they are still a board for a program, and so there's where your limitations come in and where your four boards are.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Right. Okay, we still have before us then from two to three. Is there still objection to that number?
Yes, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, Madam Clerk. Please read the roll on this amendment.
On amendment number one, the change on the bottom of page one from the two members to three. Madam Becker?
Yes.
Madam Crane?
No.
Mr. Jones?
Yes.
Ms. Gottschewski?
No.
Mr. Keel?
No.
Mr. Nankervis?
No.
Ms. Troll?
Yes.
Ms. White?
Yes.
Mayor Sanford?
Yes.
5-4, motion carries.
Mr. Jones?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Amendment number two, and I understand from the attorney that we can pass this motion and they can actually put the wording in, but I would like to add a sunset clause that this ordinance would sunset after 3 years on its effective date. And the reason for that is I would like the assembly, besides in here we do have a couple of reports that are due on specific dates, but I want the assembly to be able to revisit this in 3 years to see if it's been a success, to see if it's been working, to see if it's gotten this kind of staff support. And I just didn't want it to be out there until there was a problem that we set up a time of review.
Thank you. Is there any objection to the sunset clause? Mr. Nankervis.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I object. I don't think it's necessary. I think that we can, if we don't like what they're doing after 4 or 5 years, then we can deal with it. I don't think you have an automatic sunset clause into it. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments? We have an objection. So the sunset clause, amendment two.
Okay, amendment two. Ms. White?
No.
Ms. Troll?
No.
Mr. Nankervis?
No.
Mr. Keel?
Yes.
Ms. Gladyshevsky?
Yes.
Mr. Jones?
Yes.
Ms. Crane?
Yes.
Ms. Becker?
No.
Mayor Sanford?
No.
Motion failed.
Thank you. We have before us the main ordinance 2015-18, as amended. Mr. Nankervis.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I'd like to offer an amendment to the maker of the motion.
A friendly amendment to the maker of the motion?
I think I'm allowed to do this, aren't I?
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Well, I got to get the okay from him.
No.
So not to provide it to him.
Not to make
no,
it.
No, we don't
not
do it.
All right.
No.
Page 2 of 4, under section 4, line 7 and 8. It says report to the committee of the whole no less than a quarterly basis. I don't believe that's realistic. We don't get that from anybody. I think it needs to be on an annual basis, and if we think we need more reports, we call them to a meeting more often than that. But I believe annual is what we require of pretty much everybody else. I don't see why this one would need to be any different. Mostly because I don't think it's realistic. We're going to be able to schedule them in 4 times a year.
Does any object to changing that to annual? Hearing no.
Is that what his motion was? Yep. To change quarterly to annual?
Yes. Any objection to that? Hearing none, so ordered. Now, back to the original motion.
What? Can I just clarify that third amendment? Is it acceptable if it reads, shall report to the committee of the whole on an annual basis?
Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry, that's what I wrote in mine, on an annual basis. Thank you.
Okay, anything else before us? I think the main motion is still before us, so if there's no objection to the main motion.
As amended.
As amended. Three times.
Twice. Three tries.
Is there any objection to the ordinance passing? Seeing none, so ordered. And I would just like to take 1 minute here after passing this one. It's important that we get this information back to us as the assembly, and it's important that Parks and Rec deal with this advisory board in a professional manner, listen to their ideas and their thoughts. This is kind of what got us into trouble on the aquatic system that we had, and their advisory board, and I just want to make sure that staff knows and is upfront, and we, the assembly, want to see this work. We want you to listen to our advisory boards, and sometimes that doesn't happen. So just take that as a caution, and please. Okay, we'll move forward to unfinished business. Ordinance 2014-14. Do we need to read this in, Madam Clerk?
An ordinance amending the land use code relating to rezoning procedures.
Madam Manager.
Ordinance 2014-14 amended CBJ 4975-130 in recognition of the legislative nature of rezoning decisions was adopted by the Assembly on September 29, 2014 with an effective date of 30 days after current outstanding appeals are resolved. The only relevant outstanding appeal on September 29, 2014 was the Bicknell versus Planning Commission appeal, which was understood at the time to be close to resolution. That appeal has not yet been resolved and is being briefed by the parties. The Planning Commission will consider a new round of rezoning applications on April 14, 2015. The same legal issues that precipitated Ordinance 2014-14 will continue to exist until the ordinance becomes effective. The effective date of an ordinance may be changed by a motion to amend something previously adopted. If the Assembly wishes to clarify that a new rezone protest be afforded the new process adopted by Ordinance 2014-14, it may do so by moving to amend previously adopted 2014-14 and articulate a new effective date. I recommend the Assembly move to amend Ordinance 2014-14 and set an effective date in 30 days with the understanding that the ordinance will apply to all protests heard after the effective date, regardless of the date of filing.
Thank you. Ms. Craig?
Nothing.
You want to move?
No. All right. I move adoption of Ordinance 2014-14C AM and ask for unanimous consent.
Mr. Jones.
I guess I object for clarification. The ordinance that is signed by the mayor on September of 2014 states that this ordinance shall be effective 30 days after the current outstanding appeals are resolved. So Ms. Crane's question is to basically adopt I think the question is being asked about to change Section 3, the effective date, to be 30 days after the adoption by eliminating the current outstanding appeal resolve. And I would like to think about what the rest should be in terms of effective of when they filed, if they've been to be considered after the effective date, even though they were filed before the ordinance, then they fall under this, if that's my understanding. But I'm not exactly sure of the wording, but I don't think Ms. Crane's motion is correct, and basically motion is to amend that ordinance that we've already adopted.
Yes, me.
So this is a motion to amend something previously adopted, but because the effective date is separate from the substantive portion of the ordinance, you can adopt a new effective date for the ordinance. Technically, 30 days has already passed. 30 days has already passed since the date of the adoption. So it might be that technically you could say it is effective immediately. We do have other ordinances that go into effect immediately upon adoption. To be safe, or just if you are more comfortable doing so, we can make the effective date 30 days from today's date. The reason for requesting the additional language was just to make clear to the new pack of rezone applicants whose cases are being heard on April 14th that the process that's going to be in place is this process, because there are things that happen within the time frame while the ordinance will, before the effective date, the 30 days effective date, that will apply. For example, under the new process, the Planning Commission's decision is posted on the CDD website within 10 days of the hearing. If there is going to be a protest, if the Planning Commission's decision is to recommend denial, the applicant has 20 days from that date to file a protest, and then that will become before you for scheduling. So it was just to make, it was just to put everybody on the same page to make sure everyone understood that this is the ordinance that will apply.
Then I guess, Mr. Mayor, if I might, for clarification, what language do we need to change, and what is the language we need to change to, which is very unclear to me, and if it takes an at ease to figure that out, that would be good.
It was the language that Ms. Kiefer just suggested, which was the motion is a motion to amend something previously adopted, and the amendment, that's, I looked it up in Robert's Rules, and the amendment is to change the effective date.
To be 30 days from
what? So I just need to withdraw my motion. Okay. I will withdraw my motion with the mayor's.
Thank you, Ms. Green.
Would you like to make
another one? Okay, so the motion, the proper motion, would be the last sentence of the paragraphs that are before it with the effective date, whatever that is.
And 30 days from today.
30 days.
But didn't you just say that there were appeals to be held before 30 days?
Yeah. There are rezone applications that are to be heard on the 14th.
Okay, so 30 days from today is fine.
If we change the ordinance so it's effective 30 days from today. We're basically amending this so that the effective date is actually 6 months after the effective date that's already been passed. This says the ordinance shall be effective 30 days after the 29th day of September 2014. Why would we amend it to be effective 30 days from today?
Because the then pending appeals are still pending. The motion was amended to make the effective date 30 days after the then current appeals were resolved. Those appeals, that one appeal has not yet been resolved. That's what's causing the problem.
So the amendment then would be this ordinance shall take effect 30 days after April 6, 2015, and you would delete the words after current outstanding appeals are resolved?
Correct. The only clarification that I was requesting was to make clear that this new process is going to apply to the applicants that are coming before the Planning Commission on the 14th.
Mr. Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I'm having a charter problem, and I'm hoping the attorney can walk me through it. Because when I look at Section 5.3 of our charter, it says, and maybe the first few words are the key, except as otherwise provided in this charter. So maybe it isn't otherwise provided. But then it says, every adopted ordinance shall become effective at the expiration of 30 days after adoption or at any later date specified in the ordinance. And then it goes on to, you know, talk about budgets and mill levies, which this is not. But I look up above at A, which talks about how you present an ordinance and pass one, and this ain't it. This thing we're possibly doing tonight ain't how you pass an ordinance or any of that. So, I mean, I guess the concern goes to the public notice requirements inherent in this section of the charter.
There is no public hearing process related to an effective date. So the Robert's Rules, the direction from Robert's Rules when something like this needs to occur, which this is an unusual situation, is to do so by moving to amend something that had been previously adopted. That's what occurred, and we are changing the effective date. The effective date under our ordinance, because today is 30 days after adoption, it could be today, but just to make it abundantly clear and I suggested the 30 days out because the rezone applications hadn't been filed yet. And like I said, because there are things that happen after the hearing that would be affected by this ordinance, I requested that it be made clear that this would apply to the rezone applications. If you don't want to pass this, if you don't want to go down this road, I can tell you that what would occur if someone challenges a rezone decision by the Planning Commission, if it is a denial, the applicant would file an appeal. The appeal, though, could not come to you as an appeal to be heard under 0150 because it is a legislative decision. So it would be a waste of time to require an applicant to go to that process when the remedy can't be afforded to the applicant as part of an appeal process, which is why we amended the ordinance.
I appreciate that. I get it. I get the reasoning behind it. I just, when I look to the charter and the process it lays out, it says that anything but the default effective date needs to be specified in the ordinance. And I don't believe that the charter would allow us to go back and change 130A to make it 15 days instead of 10 days as an amendment after the fact to something we already passed. And so I don't think it allows us to go back and change the effective date in the ordinance after the fact. I think it takes a new ordinance that goes through the provisions in the charter.
I believe that it does. And that's my legal opinion, is I believe that we are allowed to change the effective date and that this is the mechanism for doing so, because you're not changing the substance of the ordinance. You don't want to reintroduce and have a new public hearing on the substance of the ordinance unless that's what you decide to do. But that's not the purpose of what it is we're doing. We are changing the section of the ordinance that deals with the effective date, which I believe this is the process to do so based on my research. So, I mean, that's all I can tell you. I did read that section of the charter, and this is my understanding of how we address this problem.
Mrs. Becker.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I move that we amend the previously adopted ordinance, serial number 2014-14 CAM, to make the effective date 30 days after April 6, 2015, and ask for unanimous consent.
I object.
Thank you. You wish to speak to your objection? Or?
I already did.
Thank you.
So, I can go on, but I can't. Go on.
I guess I would speak to the objection because the attorney said that this amendment would make it abundantly clear that the process going forward would be the process in this ordinance to issues coming before the Planning Commission on April 14th. I fail to understand how setting an effective date 30 days from today makes it abundantly clear that any action on the 14th falls under this ordinance. So maybe there's some other language that isn't in the motion that Ms. Becker put forward or that I don't understand, but it's not, this amendment does not solve or create the condition that the attorney says it will create.
May I hear?
Yes.
There is nothing happening on the 14th that is addressed in this ordinance. The ordinance addresses what happens after the 14th. After the 14th is when the protest or what used to be the appeal would be filed, and we would deal with what happens procedurally when someone wants to challenge a decision from the Planning Commission. The hearings on the rezone haven't happened yet. That's happening on the 14th. There's no change in the law with respect to that process. It's only what comes afterwards. And even if you were to do, like I said, even if you were to do nothing, the ultimate outcome is going to need to be the same. But the new protest process that you've created would not be afforded to the applicant. That was the reason for asking for the amendment. But what's happened on the 14th, that process doesn't change, even if the ordinance were in effect right now.
Mr. Nankervis.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I have a question then. So let's say they come back on the 20th and file an appeal.
The Planning Commission's notice of decision is posted up to 10 days after. What would happen after it's posted is if someone wants to challenge whatever decision the Planning Commission made, they would file. They have 20 days to file. So under the timeline, the notice of decision is posted on April 24th. If it's a recommended denial, the applicant has until May 14th to file a protest, which is after the effective date of the ordinance. So even if you didn't add the language, the end result is the same. I just thought it would be clearer to the applicant about what's going to apply when the timeline for filing the protest comes. There can't be an appeal filed after the effective date of the ordinance because we don't allow for that process anymore. If the ordinance, if the recommended decision from the Planning Commission is an approval, well, remember that comes to you as an ordinance, it would be up for introduction either on April 27th or May 18th, depending on how quickly the ordinance comes from CDD, and there would be a timeline after that someone could file a protest or speak to it at public hearing if they chose not to file a protest. So the important dates happen after the effective date, even if you don't add any of the clarifying language.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. But if the notice is posted on the 24th, they can appeal on the 25th, which is before the effective date of this, if we make it 30 days.
They can file a request for an appeal. That doesn't mean it gets scheduled. I don't know many things that would get scheduled the day after that. So there's still a timeline that occurs before which anything happens. When it gets heard by either this body or on appeal under the old process in front of the Planning Commission, which is the piece that I think would be an inefficient use of everyone's time, including the applicants, the timeline still, the 30 days is still going to be passed before it gets to this body. So it would still be the new ordinance that's in effect.
Any other questions or comments? And it's crystal clear to everybody?
Clear may not be the right
word. It is clear to no one in the public. There was no public notice given of this, and that's what the charter is about.
Next, Mr. Keough, anything else?
We have a motion before us to adopt 2014-14C and put in the clause about articulating a new effective date 30 days from today, the 6th. Does that do your motion, Ms. Becker?
Yes, it does.
And we have objections to that?
Yes.
Thank you. Take the roll, please.
Ms. Crane?
Yes.
Mr. Jones?
No.
Ms. Gladyszewski?
Yes.
Mr. Keel?
No.
Mr. Nankervis?
No.
Ms. Troll?
Yes.
Ms. White?
Yes.
Ms. Becker?
Yes.
Mayor Sanford?
Yes.
Motion carries.
Thank you. We'll move on to new business. Madam Manager, we have export manufacturing property tax exemptions in front of us.
Correct. We've got three companies that have requested this tax exemption: Alaska Glacier Seafood, Talking Smokeries, and Alaska Brewery. The total property value requested for exemptions this year is $1,625,000. This would result in a tax loss of $17,476. And individual company amounts are detailed in the packet material. The assessor's office reviewed the exemption applications and determined that the properties met the code requirements. The Assembly Finance Committee reviewed this issue at its March 18, 2015 meeting and recommended board the tax exemptions for 2015 to the full Assembly for approval. I recommend approval of these exemptions.
Thank you, Madam Manager. Can I have a motion?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I move approval and ask unanimous consent.
Is there any objections? So ordered. We have before us item B, Madam Manager.
Yes, currently we have a memorandum of agreement with Gold Belt that will be expiring in July 2015. The mayor and deputy city manager met with Gold Belt board chair and chief executive in February. Both parties agreed that the agreement should be renewed without changes. I recommend the authority. I request the authority to enter into this agreement.
Thank you. Is there anybody in the public who wishes to comment on this? Seeing none, public comment is closed. Assembly action. Mr. Jones?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I would move that the Assembly give the authority to the city manager to, agree to an amendment without changes.
Are there any objections? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. Liquor license, Madam Manager, C.
I would look to Mr. Jones, the chair of the Human Resources Committee, since they addressed that at their committee meeting today.
Mr. Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. There was a protest from the Finance Committee, or from the Finance Department, and that was withdrawn just before our meeting. And so I would recommend that the Assembly not exercises right to protest the liquor license transfer.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Are there any objections to that? Mr. Nanker.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. No question. No objection. I have a question for staff before I move on this one. In the back here, it talks about ABC and some issues ABC had with this license and it being leased out. Is ABC objecting to this transfer at all? This is ours, but I'm curious, will our action just be moot? If so, why take this action?
Mr. Nankervis, there are two separate issues. One was the Finance Department recommendation to protest based on the outstanding taxes, and that was the main reason we were protesting. The issue that will be before the ABC will, and they can do whatever sanctions and or penalties at the ABC level, but first it has to go through the local governing body review. We give our recommendations or a motion to waive its right to protest the renewal or the transfer of stock ownership in this instance. It's not our jurisdiction to say that the ABC will or won't rule one way or the other on the legality of the lease issue. That's in the ABC statute, whereas what we have for our purview and our jurisdiction has to do with
thank you, Madam Secretary.
What the code allows.
Mr. Mayor, I guess what I'm struggling with then is why I would waive a right to protest somebody that is doing something possibly illegal. It just doesn't sit well with me, so I object.
Mr. Jones.
I think the ruling of whether it's legal or not is not within our jurisdiction. The only thing we can protest on is issues in the police department, fire department, or sales tax or property tax division. There are no issues, so we don't have any jurisdiction on the other. So there's nothing for us to officially act on.
Any other comments, questions?
Mayor Sanford, I guess I would clarify. There is some broad language within our code section in 2025 that does allow us to protest on that. I'm looking through our package to see if I can find that section.
Student mayors, do you have to go home now, do you think? Blame it on the mayor. Right?
We're having so much fun.
It's riveting that you're in
part. I got permission at 6 to stay out until 10, but that permission might have expired 20 minutes after issuing it.
Well,
So, Mayor Sanford, CBJ Code Section 2025-025 does provide for the assembly to protest under the following criteria, and going down to number 9B and C. B is any violation of AS Title 4, and C is any violation of the alcohol beverage control laws of another state as a licensee of that state.
So do we need to just send this back to staff and let them figure it out with the ABC board and then bring it back before us?
Do we have time?
No, I'm not. I'm looking for the, where's the stuff we're doing? I don't see it.
You made the motion.
We have one.
We do have time.
We do have time to be able to continue that review within our 60-day window.
So, Mr. Jones, you made the motion and brought forward from the AHA. If it's all right with you, we'll forward this to staff to look at and see if there's any follow-up that we need to do with that part of it that we don't know about yet.
Is that okay with you, Mayor?
Okay, are there any objections to doing that, taking that action? Okay, we'll do that. Thank you. Next is staff report on Juno Runway 826 rehabilitation contract. Madam Manager?
Per the code, I need to inform the Assembly that I have approved a supplemental for the airport project. Actually, for the airport, it's a supplemental to the Runway 826 rehabilitation project. It's a $16 million project, and the airport staff requested that the contractor do work on Alex Holden Road. It will save the city bid prep costs, mobilization, and the work can be completed while that equipment is already there, and it's very similar work to do that that road work on Alex Holden. The cost that's proposed for that work is $64,000, so it's well within the percentage of the supplemental. Given that it's under the requirement for the Assembly to approve it, I went ahead and approved it, and I'm giving you that notice now. The letter is in your packet under staff reports.
Mr. Dan Kervis.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Question for staff, and there's more staff. Airport Manager DeLabriere is here as well. But my recollection is that's nowhere near the cost to fix it. This sounds like we're just paving it. So basically, we're just building a smooth surface at the bottom of the lake. Temporary lake. It's not a full-time permanent lake. It's just a temporary
lake. My understanding is that they were going to do some reshaping of the road, bringing in some fill and doing some paving on that. And definitely the airport manager had more direct conversations, and she can provide more detailed information.
Mr. Mayor, if you can fix it all for $64,000, I think that's great, but
no,
I'm highly skeptical.
No, we can't fix it all for that. Basically, what we're trying to do is get rid of those potholes.
Name.
We're trying to get rid of those potholes.
Name.
Patty DeLabriere.
Thank you.
The airport. Trying to get rid of the potholes that are down in there, and also grading it up and taking care of some of the dirt and debris that was in there that's actually blocking some of the drainage in there. So we're hoping we can actually do a Band-Aid approach on this, do something for an interim until we can do a long-term fix.
Thank you.
Ms. DeLabriere, do you know, is it going to be 2 or 3 years before engineering gets to this for us or not?
I suspect it'll be somewhere more like 3 to 5 years, is my guess.
Mr. Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. The source of the $64,006.
We've put aside $105,000 in the FY15 budget for this, our operating budget.
While this is just under $65,000 for the CECONS portion, we still have some administrative costs and costs that our airfield will be doing with the drainage. So it'll still come in under that $105,000, but be close to it, I think, at the very end.
Any other questions? Comments? We don't need any action from the assembly. The manager wanted us to know about this and that she took these actions, and so now we are all informed. Okay, we have update from the city attorney. Thank you. Update from the city attorney on Gastineau Park.
I was asked to provide a memo outlining your options with respect to moving forward with the Gastineau apartments. As an update to that memo, we did meet with Mr. Barrett and his mother, the two property owners, on on April Fool's Day. I explained in the memo the Barretts have requested until July. It's their intent to send out private RFPs to work with one or two different companies to accomplish the demolition and then eventual sale. Should you desire to go down that route, my recommendation is that we agree to that within the context of a demolition agreement. Otherwise, your options are as explained in the memo. There are basically two main processes. One is the eminent domain process. The other is a code enforcement or a nuisance action. If you decide, really, which route you go depends on whether or not you can articulate a public purpose for the process, for the property. If you can't at this time, but it is an option you want to move forward with or leave open, you can order the demolition and have that code action started with the understanding that if the Barretts were not to comply with the demolition order, your options at that time would be to either then file an eminent domain action or to go to court to ask that we be allowed to do the work and place a lien for our costs incurred. That is the one piece that is not answered under state law, which would require a court action. So you can begin the code enforcement process and then choose an ultimate action later. So I'm looking for direction.
Comments, questions, wishes of the assembly? Would you like to hear from Mr. Barrett while he's here? First time he's been here with us?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Barrett, 2 minutes.
All right. I brought copies of letters that I wrote to the city attorney's office. I made 30 copies, I think that would suffice. And that kind of adequately explains our position. What specifically would you like to know?
What are you going to do? What are you going to do, and when are you going to do it?
Okay, that's a difficult question. We've been pushed back quite a bit. Our initial intention was to restore the property. That's my personal preference. However, the investors, and you can read through the letters. The first letter is the one to the city attorney's office. The second one is a letter to you guys, just kind of updating what we've had. We have an open bidding contract or a request to a bunch of different construction companies that operate in both Washington and Alaska for demolition. Again, like I said, that's not my personal preference. But there are investors who are looking towards doing stuff downtown. Mostly kind of tourist-related or hotel kind of types of operations.
Mayor?
Yes?
That didn't answer the question.
The question is,
I am at the point where I want an answer to those questions. We have discussed this. I can only speak for myself, but I am ready for action.
Well,
no more delays.
Go for me.
What? Oh, sorry.
Go for me.
Mr. Mayor, I would like action as well, and I would like action to be done by now. However, with the press and the a kind of a political environment with this property. The investors that were looking to restore the property, and all of them were well-heeled, they've got scared with the city's talking about this. And I actually truly believe we've had property sold or started a negotiated a project by now had it not been so public. There are groups like Alaska House Finance Corporation that are highly interested, but you have to get an investor that wants to take the risk. No one's going to buy a piece of property if you guys are going to sweep in with this, I hate to call it an offer, but a statement of that's worth $50,000, which the according to case law is not the appropriate valuation. So you can read through my letter if you're trying to get a bit of an idea. I would like to see the property sold tomorrow or an agreement made to redevelop it. I'm still interested in doing that.
Any other comments, questions? Mr. Nanker.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I still didn't hear a when.
There isn't a when, okay. Unfortunately. I wish there was, but these things take time and money, and there's a lot of soft costs, and a lot of the companies have actually invested quite a bit of time analyzing what is the best, highest possible use. The general consensus amongst all of them is a mix of residential and residential and commercial space. Different companies want different concessions from the city. Tax abatements or pocket park or whatever, I can't even pronounce it, but the little park there, that to be returned to the, that was originally part of the building's property, and I believe it was a hardware store at that time. But they all want concessions that has to be negotiated with the city. And if I'd like to see something happen tomorrow. Go ahead.
Ms. Mead, how do we walk down the path of demolition agreement?
There would be an order from the building official. It would encompass the order from the building official to demo the property by a certain date. As part of it, though, it would require the Barretts to agree to the demolition and agree to do the work, and have them agree that should they fail to do so, they acknowledge that the CBJ would be entitled to do the work at their expense by placing a consensual lien on the property.
That's how we get to a demolition for the date. Ms. Crane.
Or we do a declaratory judgment, and we can get to demolition that way, where we, as the memo suggested, we avoid the uncertainty of the administrative process. We go straight to the court, filing a complaint for a judgment, asking the court to declare the property a public nuisance, and ordering its demolition.
What page are you on?
Page 5 of 5 in her memo.
Thank you. Okay, any other questions on that? Mr. Jones.
The result of either of those two processes is that the property remains in the ownership of the current owners. Is that correct?
Ms. Lee?
Unless the lien is foreclosed upon, yes.
So basically, we end up having to tear the building down and putting a lien on their property in order for us to exercise an action on that lien that may, in fact, remove the property from the current owners.
That is correct.
I don't think I can go down that road. I think that it's been too long. I think my preference is to take the property with eminent domain, put in the expense of tearing it down with the idea that possibility is, if it's a public purpose, that we use it for new city hall, and when that's built, we sell this place.
And how much would that cost us, the eminent domain part? Did you put prices in here?
Well, it's there are no legal costs, obviously. The cost is going to be the same pretty much regardless. With an eminent domain proceeding, the way it works is you submit to the court, you deposit with the court what you believe the just compensation for the property is. What would have to happen would be the last report that we received from Jensen Yorba from Alaska Housing, we would provide to Mr. Horan so that Mr. Horan could update his appraisal. That amount is what we would rely on. We would deposit with the court to the amount that Mr. Horan suggests is just compensation for the property. We are required, if the final judgment from the court is 10% or more, then, am I saying this right, it's 10% or more than the what the appraised amount was, what we deposited, then we're entitled for full attorney's fees and costs for the defendant. So there are those costs that might be encompassed. We would have to probably pay for, we'd have to pay to update the appraisal, but those are the costs that surround the eminent domain proceeding. And then on top of that, whatever costs it's going to, whatever it's going to take to remedy the property itself, but that's outside of the eminent domain process, except for the fact that we can fold that into the just compensation amount.
So how much is the city and borough out by going down this route?
A million,
2 million?
The amount is the same regardless of what process if the Barretts fail to demo the property. I'm just going to assume, let's assume the city is doing it ourselves because the Barretts have not complied with a demo order. The estimated cost that we have received is $1.2 million or thereabouts to demo the property and make it a flat ground.
Okay. Ms. Troll.
Just have a question for Mr. Barrett here. I would like to understand whether or not you have a willingness at all to enter into a demolition agreement with us that requires the work to be done by a specific time and would agree that should they fail to do so, the CBGA could proceed at their expense. For some reference that you might be willing to look at coming into a contractual agreement on a demolition agreement.
I'm open to all possibilities. Of course, I'd have to see what the agreement looked like. We're open to all possibilities. What I'm really hoping is that the latest person who approached me will swoop in, and he wanted to do a partnership. But we haven't even got down to numbers yet. That's a local apartment building owner. So, and their intention would be to put it back together.
So what we want to do is get that thing demolished and get it out of here.
Is that what the city wants?
That's what we want done, yes.
Okay, you wouldn't want it fixed.
Well, if you can fix it, that's fine. The trouble is that we've been on this march for 3 years, and we haven't gotten anywhere. We're in the same exact boat that we were in right after the fire happened.
We were in the process of negotiating with several different parties, and then the city started squawking, and they're scared. Would you want to invest the property?
Mr. Barrett, I want to know if you'll go enter into a demolition.
If it's a favorable for both parties, yes, of course.
And will you do that within the next week, 10 days?
Sure. I have to see the document first.
Yep, I understand that. There's a possibility. Mr. Nankervis.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Mr. Barrett, we'd love for you to sell it and somebody to buy it that's not the city.
Right.
And the sooner the better.
And so would I.
Two more years is not going to be acceptable.
I understand that, and I didn't want to be sitting here 2 years ago.
I can appreciate that.
Yeah.
2 months is not acceptable to me. I think it is time to take action.
How long does it take to buy a house?
Hmm?
It takes a lot longer than 2 months to buy it just for a regular
old... Go through me, please.
Oh, sorry. Mr. Mayor, it takes a long time to put together a deal like this, particularly when it's one of the size. And if you're looking at federal or state financing, part of it, it takes time. It's a process. But all the people who started the process have stopped because of all the reports in the newspaper and stuff of that nature. They're nervous. If I could get some assurances from the city, maybe I could sit down and talk to these guys and say, hey, come on back to the table.
Mr. Keel.
Mr. Mayor, respectfully, every time we've discussed this, the Assembly has said we want nothing more than to have it privately redeveloped. And those conversations have been for, I think, 12, 18 months now. That caveat's been on there at all times. And so I end up regretfully finding myself agreeing with Ms. Crane that, you know, I'm hearing about it from out-of-town legislative staff. I'm hearing about it from visitors. Certainly I've mentioned it a few times myself that it's been 3 years.
Mr. Jones.
I was going to say very much what Mr. Keel said, that, you know, we have said, and the attorney has related conversations that she's had with us and I believe with Mr. Barrett, that if there's a willing buyer out there and they wanted to find out if the city was going to get in the way of a willing buyer, we were going to tell them that the answer is no, the city was not going to get in their way, and not one buyer has come to talk to the city. So I understand that, yes, there's probably people out there, but Alaska Housing looked at it and basically told us it wasn't viable from their standpoint. The more they did in terms of the engineering assessment, the worse the building got. And they don't believe it can be restored, the last part. So I don't think it's possible to restore it. I don't think any willing buyer out there is going to look at those engineer reports and decide that they can invest in a fixer-upper without tearing it down. I just don't think it's going to happen. And whether we order it to be demolished and end up doing it ourselves, that's just going to be another 2 or 3 months out. And I just really think we need to be in court as quick as we can to say this building's got to come down, and if they're not going to do it, we will, and we'll take the property. So I have no faith that any private negotiations of any substance are actually going on.
So I guess sitting here as one of the nine, my only concern is how much is that going to cost us to do? That's my only concern. You know, if it's $500,000, I want to know that up front. If it's $1 million or $1.5 million, I want to know that up front. And so somehow we have to get to numbers before I march down that road. It makes a difference to me.
I certainly understand, if I might, Mr. Mayor, I certainly understand your concerns. It seems to me that, and I've said this at our last couple of meetings, no matter what I've heard, no matter who I've heard it from, nothing is going to get down until this city puts up the dollars to demolish the building. I just don't believe anything else is going to happen until then. And I don't want to go down the road where we're going to end up demolishing the building and not end up with ownership of it. I just find that highly objectionable. And I just don't see any other way for that building to come down without the city doing it. If we put a lien on the property, then we have to serve on the lien. We're just, I can't emphasize enough that the building has to come down. And if we're going to end up paying for it eventually, no matter what legal processes we go through, if we do that and don't end up with ownership of that property, I think we just really wasted our time and money.
All right. So we have a direction then. Mr. Troll.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I just kind of wanted to take a moment to sort of set the record straight a little bit. I take a little bit of exception with Mr. Barrett trying to put the problem on the assembly for being in this current situation. We, as Mr. Keel outlined, we've made it clear from the get-go our interest was to have a private developer come in. We worked with Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. We went down that path. It is the appraisals that came back. It is the engineering assessments that came back. It is the second fire. It is the looting. It is the having the basement flooded. Those are not problems we created. They are problems that are more in your court, Mr. Barrett, and the situation has created. So it's not that we've raised concerns. They are out there. They cannot be ignored, and they are a public nuisance and a health and safety threat, as we learned again with the second fire.
Thank you. Director.
Just one clarification question. I have read through the memo, and every time I think I got it, new questions come up. So if we did go down the path of trying to get a demolition agreement, a signed demolition agreement with Mr. Barrett, do we risk not obtaining the ownership as Mr. Jones outlined?
Yes, all the demolition agreement does is place us farther along in that process. So the demolition order would be to demolish it by a certain date. If you don't do it by a certain date, we would have the authority to go in and do it at our cost, with those costs being a lien upon the property. And then the way that we would recover those costs would be to foreclose on the lien unless the Barretts
right.
or sold the property and somebody else paid us back. That would be how the lien gets paid. But we would not retain the property for our public purpose, no.
Ms. Crane.
Well, before this meeting, I was leaning toward declaratory judgment. But hearing no plan or time schedule from Mr. Barrett, I am now back to eminent domain and believe we should proceed down that route. And would so make a motion if you want a direction.
We have a motion before us to do this by eminent domain. Do we have Mr. Jones?
Mm-hmm. Question, if I understand correctly, we have to state a public purpose?
You do have to state a public purpose in order. The way that the process would work is if this is the direction you choose to go in, there's a decisional document that's created that outlines what the public purpose is, what we believe just compensation is. You would adopt that decisional document by resolution, and that packet gets filed as part of the complaint.
But we don't, excuse me, sorry, Mr. Mayor, okay. Just keep talking. But we don't have to do all of that tonight. We could state a purpose tonight and then come back with a resolution with the information in there, which we would either agree or not agree on at that point.
There are different public purposes that you could use the property for. We could go to court with alternative theories. You do not have to decide them right now. You could choose one. That's what we could tell the court that we're doing. Whatever we do has to be, for example, if you were going, the city hall idea, if you wanted to put it out for a bond election, then you could say to the court, we're going to do this or this. As long as they were both public purposes that were identified under the statute, that would be fine. So, no, you don't have to identify them today. As long as you understand that when we adopt the resolution, there needs to be a public purpose identified, and that is the purpose for taking the property.
And if we don't adopt those when it comes time before us, then we're not going down that path.
Correct.
Okay. I have no problem moving forward in that. I want to know the cost of what we're getting into, and nowhere do we have that. You know, and so I don't mind moving down that path as long as this isn't the final decision right here tonight by any means. So Is there objections to the motion before?
Well, only a question.
Go ahead, Mr.
So I need to understand a little better from Ms. Mead. Do you need direction from us about a purpose or a conditional set of purposes?
Yes.
Okay. So.
And then once I hear that, the cost, what the ultimate just compensation amount that we would be submitting, what the ultimate demo cost would be built into the set of documents that would be coming back to you for adoption before we did anything. But I do need to have the public purpose alternatives identified.
So I would move that we identify use for construction of a new city hall or affordable housing or a combination of the two as staff prepares all that information to bring back to us.
Do you want to include any parking component, which is allowed under the statute?
What did you say?
Any parking component as a piece of either one of those things?
That may be necessary to accommodate the codes for an office building or a housing development.
Okay, we have a direction. Is there any objection to that direction? Before we go down any path, we're going to have all that before us again, and then we'll decide for sure. Ms. Mead, do you have enough stuff?
Yes.
Is there any objection now to that path?
The path being eminent domain.
Yes. Basic purposes that we just gave.
Right.
Okay. I see no objections. We'll move down that path. Thank you. Okay, we are done with the city attorney's report. I'm not going to have a report tonight. Committee reports. Does anybody have a committee report they need to do?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. The Human Resources Committee met this evening prior to the meeting. We heard the Sales Tax Board of Appeals annual report, and we forwarded the name of Gary Jenkins to be reappointed to the Sales Tax Board of Appeals term to expire 12/31/2017.
Thank you. Is there any objections to that? So ordered.
And also in all of your red folders was a proposal that I put forward that we will talk about on the HRC meeting on the 27th related to the Social Services Advisory Board. And that's my committee report.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else that needs a committee report? We're bumping up against our time here. Okay.
I can be very brief on lands, Mr. Mayor.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. At our March 23rd meeting, the Lands Committee recommended that staff bring back a lease amendment doubling the size of the Southeast Alaska Food Bank lease and restarting it for a new 25-year term at, I believe, $1 a year. We also recommended that staff prepare a driveway easement across some CBJ land on North Douglas Island to allow owners of a private parcel to reach it. And those will both come back for the assembly. Other things we did, the assembly dealt with tonight.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Crane?
Just a quick note. We got a lot of paper this evening, but amid everything you received is the agenda and backup for the Finance Committee meeting on Wednesday night. So be sure and note that.
And we have a meeting on the 13th?
Yes.
For an appeal, right?
On the 13th, there is at 5:30 p.m. the appeal hearing for the tall timber.
I thought it was at 5.
I'm sorry. It is at 5. Excuse me. Thank you for that correction. It is late.
And a COW.
And then a COW follow-up.
This is Brandon House, or this is both?
Yep. Yes, it is.
Just so everybody knows where we're at. They're coming fast and furious. Liaison reports. Anybody have to have a liaison report tonight?
No,
seeing none. Presiding officer report. Anybody?
You just did it. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
continuation of public participation on non-agenda items. Do we have anybody from the public who wishes to address us? Seeing none, public comment is closed. We don't have an executive session tonight. And the students, I've got your certificates here. I'm going to adjourn and come up and give them to you. And then our assembly members may have questions for you. If you can stay another 5 or 10 minutes, that'd be great. So thank you very much for participating.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Kroll?
I do have an assembly comment, but I was also wondering if our acting mayors have a thought that you would like to share before we adjourn tonight on the experience. And
this is really cool to see the process, how you guys make decisions. So thank you.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was really incredible, like, how complex it is and, like, how much stuff is, like, actually done here. It's, like, it's really neat. It's really cool.
Mm-hmm. And this one was a little bit more.
You got a big night.
Definitely, you caught us on a very full agenda night. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you guys very much for being with us.
Yes, thank you.
So we're adjourned.